Why don't we get started, folks? Today is the 12th day of September, 2019, and this is the fourth rendition of our expanded budget committee. And we have some wonderful departments to listen to tonight. We'll start out and ask Kevin, do you have any words of wisdom for us to start with? Kevin McGuire.
I wouldn't call it wisdom, but I think I got a dead mic. The correction page you have on your desks tonight is the rollover page from the summary section that we talked about on Tuesday evening.
Okay. Jason, anything? Well, then let's start tonight with our Director of Assessment, Jay Franklin. Tell us about our assessment department.
Well, thanks for having us here. You all know Irene Keough, my assistant director as well, and the one who manages the office. So I can do all of the fun things that I'm tasked to do as well. So
welcome,
without Irene, I don't know where our office would be. So it would be good to have her for the next 9 or 8 or 16 years as well. So thanks, Irene. Exactly. So here's our snapshot of the recommended budget. Just point out kind of the odd oddity to it. Looks like we have a decrease in revenue, but it's actually rollover that we used in the 2019 budget from 2018. The rollover is the purchase and electric vehicle. Kind of the main highlight of our budget this year is we're kind of converting a part-time project assistant that we would hire during our peak times of the year, whether it's at the beginning of the year for exemptions processing or the end of the year for exemption preparation. But we're taking that part-time office position, combining it with a vacant assistant real property appraiser, and then we're able to create a full-time data collector and a full-time admin assistant in our office. So we're taking 1.7 FTEs and creating 2 FTEs out of that to have 2 full-time, or to have really 3 full-time front office staff. With the 2 that we had, with 3 phone lines that come in, the public computers, when one was out on vacation or on leave, it really led to Irene being out in the front office a lot. So we really need that 3 for coverage and also for the clerical work that we have. Kind of our major influences, you all should know this by now. I've been around here for, this is probably my 9th or 10th budget presentation, but we're really dependent on what happens in the real estate market. It's kind of hard for us to know from one year to the next how much work we're going to end up doing to stay at 100%. But for our 2020 AEM, the Annual Equity Maintenance Program, we're looking at the city of Ithaca. It's still showing strong growth, both residentially and in our apartment sales. Kind of an odd thing we're seeing now in the city of Ithaca is the distinct neighborhoods that were always there are starting to blur. You know, with Fall Creek being lined by the creek and the hill, it's kind of morphing over the creeks now. So we're not having that distinct kind of neighborhoods. We're still monitoring that and seeing where that's going, but it's definitely a shift in what we've typically seen at the city. We're revaluing the town of Groton.
Jay, what does that mean? I don't understand. Does it mean that the prices are more spread out, the same prices, or what?
Correct. You know, if I use Fall Creek, there used to be a distinct value difference between on which side of the creek you're on, if you're on Willow Ave or if you're on Lake Ave. if you're on the east side or the west side. Now we're not really seeing those historic natural boundaries really causing a shift in value. It's more, are you in the flat area of the city or are you on the hills? You know, we're losing those distinct neighborhoods.
Gotcha.
And we're kind of monitoring where that's going. It's something we're internally talking about. I don't know if it's a good or a bad thing, but, you know, we're looking at how what was typical neighborhoods, how that's affecting value. And it affects us when we're trying to find comparable houses in order to value a property. It's almost helping us out as we're getting a bigger pool of houses to choose from, but it's making it more difficult because I think location comes into play a lot more than the neighborhood did.
Anna?
Question. I'm hearing that, and my given what I'm seeing as a city rep and talking to a lot of people and going to a lot of the local meetings, what I'm hearing is that the prices are increasing pretty much consistently in the non-Fall Creek area, so that it's more the leveling out. All the other flats have come up to sort of match what we've historically seen, and Fall Creek is one of the more expensive areas in the flats. Is that what you're referring? Is that kind of what you're seeing and meaning?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's almost exactly what it is. So I think what's really driving it is that when properties go on the market, they're being marketed. The city's being marketed as walkable neighborhoods now. So if you can park your car and not have to drive anywhere but can walk somewhere, whether you're on the south side or the north side or Fall Creek, those values aren't as extreme as they used to be.
Right. So essentially gentrification to,
yes,
you know, for,
yes,
a lot of the people. And this is very good evidence because what I'm hearing happening in the city, which is a lot of downzoning encouraged from some of the electeds, this information, I will make sure that it's shared because I think it's important for them to hear. Thank you.
Henry.
Are prices in Fall Creek also going up?
Yes.
So everyone's going up.
Everyone's going up.
But the relative difference is decreasing.
Go ahead, Jay.
We're revaluing the town of Groton as well, the town of Ithaca, both the South Hill and West Hill. We did the cigarette streets this last year. The Dryden Villages as well. I think more out of equity than market. You know, we haven't been out there and reviewed those areas in a while, and we just want to make sure that we haven't missed anything within the last few years. It's getting tougher. The complexity of the transactions and the inventory we have to value. You know, we're getting into air rights with the new planned development on Green Street and how that affects value. We're getting into the NYSEG smart meters, broadband. As 5G rolls out, we'll have more. We have the new Tesla fueling stations down in front of Staples. How much value is there? And those are complex because gas stations, the gas pumps are typically considered personal property and not real property. So is an electric fueling station real property? And then you get into what is the value of that. So it's a lot of new and odd things are coming in that are taking up a lot of time doing research, looking at what value it may be in addition to is it real or personal property. And then, of course, we have our annual work. Even if we didn't do our annual equity maintenance program, you know, we average around 2,200 building permits per year that we go out and investigate and data collect that information. And then, of course, legislative changes. We'll see what New York State's going to end up doing with STAR this next year. I think since at least 2015, every year they've done something to it. So I would anticipate something again in the 2020 legislative session. And then any additional new exemptions that come about. I know we're discussing the capital improvements to residential properties. We'll also bring the business improvement exemption. With more exemptions mean more work, which means less time for us to dedicate to other work that we're doing in our office. So I'll be on speed dial if anything major pops up that requires a little more assistance. Here's our full-time equivalents. I didn't put in the slide that I normally do. Back in 1999, we had, I think, 19.75 FTEs. Through technology, we were able to reduce it. Coincidentally, we also hired Irene in 1999, too. So we were able to reduce some staff from there as well. Ideally, we'd be at just a shade over 14, according to the International Association of Assessing Officers staffing guidelines. But because of the people I have and the multiple work that they can do and the juggling that they can do, we're good right now at 12 and a half. You know, I have Irene, we have Tamara Van Orman in the front office, all of our appraisers, Vang, Kathy, Steve, Carrie, Barb. Miss anyone? And, of course, Al Fiorelli, our part-time commercial appraiser who can do the job of a person and a half in a half of time. I think that's it.
We have questions. Martha.
Hi, Jay and Irene. You didn't add in there that you're going to be doing the power plant pilot, and you help us with downtown facilities, and you do a lot of additional things kind of in the as-needed category. So thank you. I am curious about the position changes. So is that kind of salary neutral to go to the 1.7 that you had to point to 2?
Correct. Yeah. The data collector is a few grades below the assistant real property appraiser. And then taking the $25,000 that we had set aside for the project assistant, combining those, we're able to fit that in under our target budget without negatively affecting any other of the line items that we have.
Okay. All right.
So we looked at it as a kind of a win-win. And with the data collector, hopefully we'll have our certified list next Monday. And we'll be able to bring someone in kind of at the lower level. And we've had good luck with data collectors in the past. I was hired as a data collector in 97, so hopefully we can continue that tradition.
All right, that's a high bar to set.
Yeah.
So, all right, thank you, Jay.
Ann?
Thank you for the presentation, Jay. So I just also had another question regarding the changes of the FTEs. So the project assistant, was that for special projects?
Well, that was each year we needed help at the beginning of the year when all of the seniors, the farmers are coming in to file all of their exemptions. So we typically would hire someone in January. They'd work through May. And then ideally we would hire someone again in October. We'd get them trained in how to handle those exemptions. And then they would work through until the next May. So we didn't hire over the summer. One nice thing about our work is our traffic for the public kind of dies down during the summer months until school tax bills come out. So we're able to cover the office during those periods, but we needed that extra help.
And the appraiser, so you're taking out the one property appraiser?
Yeah, it will be a challenge to cover that extra valuation work that's needed, but I think by shifting some of the appraiser's data collection duties, we can get appraisers appraising and data collectors collecting.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to send one of our valuation specialists out to measure a garage. That's work more better served by a data collector. We can get them in, train them how we want them to do the work, and hopefully they're not going to stay data collectors for long. Hopefully they'll be able to graduate them up into an assistant real property appraiser, to appraiser, eventually to director.
Thank you.
I had a couple questions. One, how's it going with our contract with Covert?
I think it's going great. Irene goes out there on Thursdays. They just created office space for us out there, which is nice.
It's 6x7. It's basically the same size as our supply closet across the driveway, but they're, for the amount of time that we're there, it's good.
Yeah, we do have a window they're creating now, so we can actually do work in the office, and so it's going good. I think the public out there really enjoys having us out there as a full-time assessment office. While we're out there for 2 hours, 3 hours every week, you know, they can call our office from 8 to 4:30 and they can get a response. You know, we get phone calls from other towns up there as well trying to get an answer if they can't contact their assessor. So I think it's a good show of intergovernmental cooperation and consolidation there.
Are there other towns interested in contracting?
We've been approached.
Leave it at that.
The tough part is you know, you can take on a little more work without adding more people. If we took on a lot more work, you'd have to add more people. We'd have to think about location and space needs, and so we would either need to take on a lot more work or no more work at all to really make it worthwhile, I think.
And the other question I had, have you had any negative feedback about not doing our local assessment review boards?
You must have read my mind. I was looking at how to present that to GO coming up, and I haven't heard anything. You know, I heard from some towns that were questioning why we did it, but I haven't heard any responses from them that would show up as a negative. You know, our grievances were down again this year. We only had 197 this year. So I think we still have the opportunity by appointing the three temporary hearing panels. You know, there's still three boards for people to show, but it's one of the things, we don't have any hard data. I can't point out and say, you know, we took six phone calls. I can honestly say I haven't taken a phone call from a property owner that was questioning why we did it after the fact.
Martha has a question, then Glenn.
Yeah, I should have asked. So the project assistant and the assistant real property appraiser, those positions are going away. Are there incumbents in those positions right now?
No, the project assistant was always a temporary position. And then we had a vacancy with the assistant, the real property appraiser, in June.
Okay. And you haven't filled them, so this is a restructure. Okay.
Correct.
Thanks very much.
Jay, with the new assessment review for the four towns, you don't expect any need for an assessment review board?
No. This is pretty typical in our work. I would almost say it's going to be a light year in terms of our number of changes. You know, we probably average 10 to 12,000 changes per year. We'll probably get 7 to 8,000 this year. So I don't think it's that out of line with the work that we've done.
Okay, thank you both. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
And we're a minute ahead of schedule, folks. And just, I promised I would remind everybody that we're only asking questions. We're not debating. We're not making extended statements tonight. We've got the Human Resources Department, and Lisa Holmes is our acting director.
It's been a year since I've come before you with a budget. So the recommended 2020 budget for the Department of Human Resources is approximately $1,229,000, which is about a 4.5% decrease from the 2019 budget. And that decrease is primarily due to, you can see, a change in expenditure of about $65,000. And that was a two-year OTR to provide for staffing overlap and training to assist with anticipated retirements. 2019 was the first year of that OTR, and the retirement occurred in 2019, with the staff trainee now performing the duties of that position. So that OTR will not be needed for 2020 to continue. So that's the explanation for that change. Also, that the revenue change that you see in 2019 was rollover used to provide some weeks of overlap in training in the deputy commissioner position, where there was another retirement in 2019. So you'll note that retirements of long-term staff is a theme in the HR budget that I'll probably be going back to. So next slide. Here's a slide that many of you have seen before with some slight updates. I'm getting to know this in a whole new way. These are the functional areas that that the HR department covers. Starting on the left-hand side is the mandated side, the Civil Service Administration for 50 civil divisions, which include our 27 county departments and 23 municipalities, school districts, and special districts. It involves all the handling of the duties and functions on the list, and the HR staff does a great job with this. It was noted earlier this year that we received the results of a technical audit by the New York State Department of Civil Service, which was very favorable, near perfect this spring, very few errors, which is unheard of for the amount of amount that they're responsible for, the amount of transactions. Next on the list is the Human Resources Administration for over 720 county employees with the duties as described. We have Employee Benefits Administration for active and retired employees, and Labor Relations for the county's four collective bargaining units and the management and confidential employees. So, a lot on the plate. I'll go through the major influences I see, and I think the staff sees, in the for the 2020 budget affecting us. HR staff development in general. Well, the HR department should be and is at the heart of staff development for the entire organization. We first need to look at the internal HR staff development. And due to many retirements in 2018 and 2019, we lost several decades worth of institutional memory. There was there were efforts made for overlap, as you saw before, and there so there's a lot of transfer of that knowledge. But currently, the HR staff numbers six, and three of whom came on in the last year. And more about to be coming on board. So this is a lot of new people to bring up to speed on departmental and organizational processes. It's a small but mighty staff, and they do a great job. But we're definitely in a period of departmental restructuring where we're assessing the needs of the department and assessing the needs of the entire organization and aligning the positions and the training within HR to meet both those needs, and definitely streamlining processes. And all of this work was in process before I came downstairs to help out, and will continue. For example, they're transitioning all of the paper roster cards to an eGov system. There's a greater use of LaserFiche for tracking and certifications. There's a lot going on. between HR, ITS, payroll. So that work is ongoing. We have anticipated department heads searches coming up, three known searches that will take place later this year and early next year, others on the horizon, and support for other potential high-level hires that require HR's support and guidance. And then the climate survey follow-up. As a result of last year's climate survey, as those results are shared among departments, employees have become very engaged in that process, and it has necessitated a greater level of follow-through and accountability on behalf of managers and the HR department, which is a great thing. And so HR provides support on both sides of the equation to the employees and the managers throughout that process, and in support of the greater goals of the organization in promoting fair and equitable processes, clear communication, supervisory training, and the like. So, again, all of these items that are coming as a result of the climate survey are very positive, and they directly impact the workload of the HR staff.
Shona Black has a question.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to know, with the increase of people that we're looking for as far as department heads, would you also see an increase in recruiting funding that's needed?
There's a recruitment position, and there are recruitment funds allocated in the budget. My understanding is the practice has been we spend through those funds and then come forward for contingency requests, because it's hard to know from one year to the next, you know, where those large recruitments may be falling. So 2019, 2020, unless I hear differently, that's the process okay.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Good question. Lastly, the full-time equivalents. When fully staffed, HR is made up of 9 full-time equivalents. That's down slightly from 2019, where we had a benefits assistant at 3/4 of an FTE who has now retired, and someone has come in to fill that role full-time. So that's it for the HR overview. Happy to take questions.
Questions. Start with Ann.
Thank you, Lisa. So you're still, with the number of positions, you're still down 0.75, even though one person went from 0.75 to 1. So can you explain, maybe I missed that, why you're still down from 2019 projections?
So I kind of went over this a few times. We had a
We had a
0.75 project assistant funded at 0.75 for 2019. What I could determine, however, was there was one employee who was working 0.75 as a 0.75 FTE who has since retired. So that was where...
Benefits assistant or project assistant? I've heard you say both.
Yeah. Well, on the books, it was a 0.75 project assistant. The person who retired was benefits assistant who was working 0.75. So
other
I can
questions.
Get back to you on that if you need.
Yeah, just wondering if that leaves you short.
I think that the... we had an over-target request last year where we had overlap in staffing to assist with training. And for that position for which that person was training, the individual retired, the trainee has moved into that position, so we no longer have that over-target request, and I think that that levels out our staffing.
Okay.
In terms of titles and who was working the .75, I can't exactly put my finger on
that. Okay. Thank you.
Sorry, Ann, I wasn't trying to cut you off. I just thought we were done with that.
No, no, that's fine. I just hadn't officially raised my hand, so I didn't want to be rude.
I said Ann. Anna, you're next.
Okay. Andy, are you've done? I'm not cutting you off either.
Done.
Okay. We're going to officially switch names every other time, so to keep you all on your toes. I had a few questions. One of them first, you said it's currently a staff of 6, so you're going to be hiring more.
That's not counting myself. So I should, I don't count myself as a permanent.
Which I totally get, which means that staff of 6 permanent, which means that we're in the process of hiring 3 more to refill it back up to the 9. And I'm not going to ask you to repeat this, but what I generally got is that on the books it was a project assistant, it was a benefits assistant that retired. They both kind of worked, maybe part-time, maybe exchangeable. We don't 100% know, but whatever it is, we're good with what we have. Moving forward, we're going to just add 3 more positions that we need to fill.
Yeah, and I want to clarify, I know who was in what role, and the benefit assistant individual retired, and that role we just hired for, she began last week, full-time. So
for benefits assistant.
We're good. Yep, for a leaves associate.
And
yes.
Then that answers one of my questions on the books, and I had a question, something we discussed last year kind of extensively, and so would love to get a sense of where this was. The travel training for the county is in this budget, and I'm curious, do we have any sense of the $164,000, how much of it was actually used from this budget?
In the current year?
Yeah.
I can look into that and let you know.
That would be great.
Mm-hmm.
And then just looking at 2 other budget lines, there's the program expenses have been dropped in half, and so I was wondering what was in that line. And there's the other category, which I always find a little bit of a conundrum, which has increased significantly. But I was wondering what's in that other world.
You said the other category?
Yeah, it's the last line in the expenses. I don't need an exact answer, but just sort of a general sense of what falls in other in this department.
The printout that I'm looking at is different than the printout you have in front of you. So those are questions that I may need to get back to you on.
So I can repeat that. It's just as a note. It's the program expenses and the other category. Those are the 2 that have changed significantly. I was just curious what they were about.
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't want to speculate. I'd prefer to.
Yes, absolutely. That's great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Have Henry Granison next.
For the 3 positions that are open, do you plan on hiring them before the end of the year?
Yes. Well, I don't want to say. We're taking a systematic approach in terms of how we're filling positions, and depending on the most pressing needs of the department. So right now, there's a lot of clerical tasks that higher level staff are performing right now, which is taking away from their ability to perform at the top of their pay grade. So right now we're in the midst of interviewing for information aid or admin 1 position to assist with some of those clerical staff. As I'd mentioned, in terms of what's happening on the horizon, we know that we have some higher level searches that the department's going to be needing to assist with, and the recruiter position will probably be next on the horizon. And then from there, I think we're just going to have to continue to assess. So, yeah, we're hoping to continue as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
Martha Robertson.
Lisa, you said there were a number of department head searches. I know we've heard of a couple. I guess Office of Human Rights has been on the list for a long time. Julia Maddox just announced for Workforce Development. What are the other ones that are?
Department of Emergency Response. Those are the three known and, you know, that are out there publicly.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Good job, Lisa. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa.
And we are now 5 minutes ahead. Well, we've got two heavy departments here. First one is mental health, and Frank Krupa is here.
Yeah.
Mental health has one recommended over target.
All right. Good evening, everyone. So, starting with mental health, first, I'm not sure everyone knows Jeremy Porter. He's our fiscal administrator at the mental health department.
Hi,
joining me here.
Thanks for coming, Jeremy.
He does all the hard work.
He lied to me.
You just look pretty.
Yeah. I'm the window dresser.
Yeah.
So, starting off, our budget, there are significant changes in both expenditures and revenues, but we are within target other than the one OTR we'll talk about at the end. And I'm going to explain where these significant shifts have come from as we move through the presentation, but you can see expenditures are up, but revenues are also up significantly. The change in the net local is, as everyone else has, the growth in salaries and fringe. So what are our major influences? First thing up are revenue changes and the trends associated with those revenues. You saw on the first slide that that number is up $780,000. That is to the credit of the team we have at Mental Health. You may remember in previous years, our financial situation in the department was not strong. In fact, it was 2017 before our first year where we were in the black related to the county budget. We've been able to continue that trend and move into a situation where we have this year the ability to reinvest some of those improvements into the department, and we'll talk about what we're proposing for those. Much of the revenue improvement is through the clinic. The staff have done an amazing job of figuring out ways to see more people and be as efficient and effective as we can be with our billing practices, so we're maximizing the revenues associated with those services. Our PROS program, which is the second of the three main areas in the department, personalized recovery-oriented services, you may have in previous iterations, it was continuing day treatment, and it was before that the Skylight Club. And thanks to my good friend Kevin here, we were finally able to change it from Skylight Club, which it hasn't been for a decade, to actually calling it PROS in the budget documents this year. And so that was all Kevin. I threw him under the bus last year that we hadn't changed it, so I want to give him all the credit this year for helping us make that change. But our PROS program, we're in the third year of it, and it has steadily grown. But there were startup funds from the state that were associated with that have now gone away, and there's only a small amount that they give us for ongoing support. We were able to shift some state aid that we were applying to the clinic over to PROS to help them. The state allowed us to do that for a one-time situation for 2020 to help them continue to grow. But they will be looking to improve their sustainability over the coming year as the program continues to grow. Health homes, we had a pretty significant conversation about that last year and the financial situation that it was in. We are happy to report that we are in a better financial situation, but we have had to take some steps to get there. First, the staff have really, over the last 6 months or so, bought into the new model of having caseloads that are closer to 40 and 50. But the positive in that is the state has recognized that for some people, being on a caseload of 40 to 50 is not going to meet their need. And so because we are a legacy provider and the level of staff that we have, they're allowing us to do what are called Health Home Plus services. And the people that do that work can't have a caseload above 15 because they are doing higher acuity clients. And we get to bill more. So we are maximizing our ability to do that. I believe we are at 3 folks now that are doing Health Home Plus staff-wise and 2 that are doing the others that are carrying the 40 to 50. So we're trying to maximize what we're able to do. We've seen positive trends associated with that from a revenue perspective, and we're expecting that to continue, but we're not where we want to be yet. So we've done a couple of things to help save some resources while we continue to implement the improvements. The first is we had a retirement of the program director, which was the senior person overseeing the program. We're not planning to fill that position in the interim, which will save us some monies. We have left it in the budget because it is not sustainable long term to not have that position filled. We're doing it now to put us in a better financial situation while we're continuing to adapt to the new environment. In order to fill that void, we've increased the hours of the senior caseworker to 40, and Sharon has shifted some of her time into providing supervision for the program. So that's going to help us in the short term. You'll still see in the budget about a $400,000 number for the local share, but the reality that number right now today is about 270 as we hold that position vacant. So we're imagining that the revenues are going to continue to go up, and as they do, we'll be in a financial situation where we can come to you and say, you know, we believe we're going to be sustainable and it's time to build back into that program the appropriate administrative support. So we're trying to be responsive to the concerns about its financial sustainability while still giving the staff a fighting chance to get us where we want them to be. So that's kind of where the revenue situation is. The expense monitoring, I've talked a little bit about that. We've done it in health homes. We've also done it around the clinic with our psychiatrist positions. As some have become vacant, we've been able to move to a contractual relationship for a psychiatrist part-time. We've also held some positions vacant as we work to kind of get to a productivity level that was more sustainable. We are now fully staffed in that we are actively recruiting for any vacancies that we have. And so we are moving forward with the clinic to kind of reestablish now that we feel like we're in a better spot. We're not all the way there. Obviously, there's been we wanted to get better at meeting our budget obligations and begin to reduce the clinic's demand for county share, so that way we could ultimately reinvest those dollars. And I'll talk a bit about what we're proposing for 2020 in a minute. But really, where we're trying to position ourselves for is the future of the payment structure within the system. You may have heard me talk about value-based payments before, and the system is shifting from fee-for-service, where they just pay you for X amount of things that you did, to paying you for outcomes. So your ability to be able to improve the health of the people you're serving is what they will pay for. And in order to position ourselves for that, one, we have to be very lean and productive because they want bang for their buck. And two, it also talks about the integration of services that we've been talking about. Obviously, there's, you know, a parallel conversation about the integration of the departments, but either way, we need to be able to expand the scope of service that we're able to provide to the people we serve. So when you're talking about a mental health client that might have some primary care needs, or other public health-like or social determinant-like issues, if we can show that we have the ability to provide that wraparound, it allows us to negotiate higher rates in the value-based world, because we'll be able to say, look, we can impact the outcomes of these individuals from a more holistic perspective than someone that maybe is just treating their mental health care. So it's going to be vital that we continue to make changes to adapt to that environment as we move forward.
Shauna would like to ask a question.
Sure.
Hey, Frank. I was wondering, as far as the line items in your staff, I see that the community mental health nurse is going to be reduced by one, and also the psychiatric social worker is going to be reduced by one as well. In a time where we're trying to focus on mental health and provide services, can you talk about why this is happening?
Sure. Jeremy will talk about the logistics, and then I'll talk about it.
Okay. So the nursing position is actually a utilization review nursing position. So in PROS, we had a full-time nurse, and now we've found that you don't need a full-time nurse in the PROS program. And so she's going to do one day in the PROS program and do the health monitoring, injectable, things like that, and be our utilization review nurse. But we're increasing a rehabilitation specialist, which can provide more classes within the PROS system than a nurse necessarily can, because she had all the health assessments to do. So it's really just reassigning the position so that they can be more client-facing and provide more classes that they need. What was the psychiatric social worker?
Yeah.
The psychiatric social worker position is sort of a legacy in how we've restructured. We went to having three seniors in to oversee different units. And until everyone who was in current positions retired, there was always going to be one. We were going to save one in the end. And so that's finally come to fruition after really 2 years. It stayed in the budget as people have retired out of the clinic director positions, and now we have the senior structure. So it's really, it was never going to be refilled. It was always going to be a senior position, which we now have three. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Both of those are restructuring. It's not a loss in people. It's an identification of a better way to meet the needs. We will certainly be having conversations in the coming weeks and months about demand and social workers and how we might meet those demands.
Okay.
Those positions, thankfully, due to the improvements that we made, are generally now self-sustaining. And so when we're talking about expanding, we won't necessarily be talking about new county dollars, but talking about whether or not the demand justifies moving those forward. So those conversations will come. But what you see in this budget here today is really just reorganization within the department.
Okay. And then my second question was, I noticed that in last year's budget, we actually went from 1.7 psychiatrists to 0.7. Is there a need to increase that back up to 1.7?
So we're contracting for a psychiatrist now that would be in a different line.
It's in
okay.
Professional services.
Professional
okay,
services.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So, yeah, we have him 2 days a week. And we are actually doing work right now to try to make Dr. Duplan, our child psychiatrist, more available. We have a potential departure of one of our psychiatrists in early spring next year. So we're talking internally about what best our options would be and what type of provider we need to search for.
Thank you.
Yep. The last thing on this slide, just very quickly, the state aid adjustments. Outside of what happened with PROS, VAP, which is Vital Access Provider Grant, was for our open access program, and that was a short-term 3 or 4 year program that they funded, and we've come to the end of that. We are still providing those open access services so people can walk in, and we are paying for it with the increase in clinic revenues that we've been able to generate. The Medicaid administration is the rights... right-sizing is not the right word. The state has got a more formal process for random moment sampling about what we're spending our administration time on, and so as they've gotten better at kind of tracking that, there's obviously minor adjustments that come along with it. So that is reflected in the budget as well. It's not a huge number, but certainly a part of it. Budget impact. So let's talk a little bit about what we want to do with that $780,000 in revenues that we found. At the top of the list, probably should have been at the bottom of the list, is furniture and computers. And these are, let me talk about the computers first. That's really building back in the replacement schedule that we had kind of done away with in the lean times. So we're starting to build that back in. But there is a significant furniture number there. And the reason for that is it's a one-time expenditure. And it's something that we don't have to buy at the beginning of the year. So we can watch our trending around our revenues to make sure that we're realizing the revenues in the manner that we thought we would. And then we'll talk about how we whether it's appropriate to expend those resources. The reason that furniture is there is if you've been to our building, we've been there since 1990, and much of the furniture came with people when we moved in. So we're going to get new carpeting, thanks to county admin, so we're super excited about that. And we want to make sure that we continue to have a good environment in the building for our therapeutic, for our clients. So that's in there to help us adapt to this new, because we're seeing a trend, we're in kind of year three of the trend with revenues improving, we want to make sure that it's truly heading in that trajectory that we're proposing. So we're trying to make sure we're being smart about what we're doing. But we are proposing to invest in some staff time within the clinic. The new position that you'll see in the FTE count is for I'm going to blank on it, administrative computer assistant in our QAI group. So within mental health, we've created a quality assurance and improvement group that has been vital in helping us understand how we could improve and become more efficient, and they pay for themselves over and over again, and we feel like it's time to reinvest in some of the monies that have been created because of their work. This position is kind of a position that's also associated with the integration conversation. So should the decision be to more fully integrate the departments, what I would expect this position to do is be helping mental health a little bit, but also helping public health. And in doing that, taking some of the work that our health promotion staff is currently doing at the health department to free them up to do more of that education and outreach work at mental health that's been surely lacking for some time. If the decision is to fully separate as two departments, then that position would be there for the next leader of the mental health department to decide what to use with, but I would certainly recommend that they consider bringing some sort of education and outreach component into the mental health department. So it is us reinvesting back in to areas that we think will create value for the department and are flexible enough for whatever the decision-making process is related to integration. Care management, we talked about. We increased a senior social worker to 40 hours, and we're holding a position vacant until we see where that gets to. Clinic staffing, our seniors, Jeremy was referencing a reorganization that we did. We created senior positions, senior social workers and a senior nurse position in the department, and we're moving those up to 40 hours. What we found is those folks are carrying a part caseload, and they need time to also be able to do the senior, the supervision, and be a part of those activities. So we want to make sure that we're able to give them what they need to be successful. Pro staffing, Jeremy already talked about it. We're reducing the nursing down to one day a week, and we're putting in a rehab specialist, which is able to provide more service and class-like activities, which is kind of the foundation of PROS in that program. Financial staffing, there is a position that we envision as a state aid slash contracting type position at mental health. We are expecting that it will be one. This is kind of a reorganization position that has flexibility as well. If the integration were to occur, it would be another tool to kind of create that more streamlined administrative functions. But it would also It would also come through attrition as we looked at internal staff that might rise to that level, at which point we would eliminate their position behind them through that reorganization. If the decision is to not fully integrate, Jeremy needs help at mental health. His position has been doing the work of what we use four people to do at public health. And I think that's been reflective in kind of what has happened with the financial situation at mental health department over the years. So if you go the other direction, he's going to need help and need this position there. So we want to make sure that we're planning for either eventuality. Support staffing, this is also an addition. We have 6 front desk staff, and we are proposing to move them from 30 to 40 hours to allow for more flexible coverage of the department, coverage on the floors and coverage for when we're open. The rep payee transition that's on here, this is actually a project that's going on with DSS. We had one single person that did rep payee work, you know, held money for folks, paid bills, those kind of things. She's retiring. And it really doesn't make sense for us to continue to do that. It was kind of a legacy thing. DSS has a team of people that do that. They have supervisors that oversee that. And so we're shifting this over to them. They've agreed to take on the clients that will be remaining with us. And it will actually reduce the cost of the county ultimately because it's 100% county funded with us. DSS is able to leverage some state aid for that program. So that will be happening. We've been planning with them. It will be a transition that's related to a retirement. The full-time equivalents, I talked about what the one change is, and that's related to that quality assurance and improvement position that we've proposed. And so that's what you see in the full-time equivalents. Our over-target request is a continuation from last year, and this is our wellness court coordinator. We were able to recruit, I think it, by April, Michelle Pressure, who has been doing a superb job with Judge Miller in getting that court off of the ground. We have not yet been able to convince OCA to give us more money. I blame you guys for getting another judge, so just so you know. But we're still hopeful that we can convince them long term that we need them to take this position on. So we're asking to carry it another year forward as a one-time request at this point. And I'll stop there.
Well, that's a lot of information. Questions?
I told you I'd
mess it up. Anna.
Yeah, I always find that my hand hurts after you present because I cannot take notes fast enough to keep up with all the bits and pieces. But one of the things I did not get fast enough was in the very beginning you were talking about the caseload for health homes, something about the 40 to 50, and then you were able to compensate because of a maximum of 15. I didn't understand what you were
saying. Yeah, so the traditional health home model now, traditional, it's only been around for 5 years, is pushing towards having 40 to 50 clients on your caseload. It's more of a paperwork phone call kind of environment. The state has recognized that that doesn't work for our most acute clients, and so they created a health home plus program. Because those are higher acuity clients, they limit the caseload size of those caseworkers to 15, and we are able to bill a higher rate for the services that we provide to them.
So health homes is just, there's an assessment done, and some people go into the health homes plus, and some people go in, so you then split your case managers, so some of them do the 40 to 50, some of them do the, okay, got it. Question about, in general, when I was going through this, of all the departments, this is one of them that has a significant amount of money from state and federal. And I was curious, given the current environment that we're in right now, if you've heard any rumblings of any of these potentially losing funding, any cuts that you're worried about maybe this coming year's budget with respect to state and federal funding?
We're pretty comfortable in what we're getting now. Some of those monies are also monies that we pass along to our contracted partners in the community.
Yeah.
We're feeling, at least for 2020, that that we're comfortable with that. I think from the federal administration level, we are hearing support for mental health and behavioral health things, and there is money that is flowing for those. So there's been huge amounts of money coming to our community, not necessarily to us, from different sources, the Drug Council and other things, REACH. So I think because of the severity of the mental health and behavioral health issues that are going on, there is a focus and those fundings are coming.
And you sort of touched on my second point a little bit, but I'm curious. I know that there's a lot of funding at the federal level specifically related to mental health and opioid addiction overlap, and I'm curious if the department has been able to capitalize on any of that funding to feed into some of these programs, specifically with respect to the social determinants of health and the wraparound services you were talking about.
Yeah, not in huge numbers. I think the community is doing that, and we're supporting their efforts to do it. I think what we are trying to do is position ourselves through this conversation about the holistic health of the people we're serving to be able to better position to say, look at everything we're able to do. We're not just doing mental health. We're not just doing behavioral health. We're looking at the totality of what their needs are. If you give us dollars, you're going to get more bang for your buck. So we are positioning ourselves to be able to do that. I will tell you that we are doing things to integrate dual diagnosis within our clinic. We've provided huge amounts of training. We just recently signed up as a Narcan location, so you know the Drug Council and staff can do those trainings and give out free Narcan. We signed up to do that as well. We're not going to do the community piece of it, but it allows us to have a supply in our clinic so we can provide that to family and people that are coming to seek our services. They can just get Narcan from us as well. So it's just one more avenue to get that in the hands of people. So we are doing things both very acutely to address dual diagnosis and also prepare ourselves to be better able to serve the needs of people with dual diagnosis.
And one last small mundane, I think, and other capital equipment, there's like $150,000 increase. I'm assuming that's a one-time. I think I saw it in the mental health clinic. Is that a one-time? Pretty significant increase. Almost all of it would be in the mental health clinic under other capital equipment.
It's the furniture line.
Okay, thank you.
That's what we're talking about.
Great, thanks.
Arthur Robertson.
I just wanted to check on the, so the only new position is the admin computer assistant, but then there's the, and that fits within your budget, so that's not an OTR?
Correct.
Okay. And then the mental health, like the wellness court coordinator, are we sharing that cost with the city or something?
Yes, I put in a request to the mayor for $25,000 again, like last year.
Okay, so for this current year, the city's doing 25.
Well, they haven't said they are. I put in a request.
For this current.
Oh, for this 2019. Yes, they did. You guys gave us 50. They gave us 25. The reason we're down to 43 this year is because we bought the equipment that we needed for her, and so most of it is now salary. We don't need as much getting started monies.
Okay, so the request is, does the OCA put in anything yet?
No.
Well, then, you know, write it up for us and, you know,
we'll
get it on the list.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, we really need to lobby for that.
Sure.
Okay.
No, I agree.
All right. Thank you, Frank.
Frank, last year the positions at the jail were moved into the sheriff's budget.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how is your connection with that still supervisory or not? And is that working well?
You'd have to talk to the sheriff to get their opinion. I think it's working well. They need more. I think that's the first thing they'll tell you. We don't have a supervisory relationship at all. We moved all of that to them. They have their own medical director for the behavioral health and mental health side of things. The social worker kind of gets her guidance from them. We do still have the reentry position that seems to be going really well. We're looking at, you know, the potential for what that might be into the future and whether it needs to grow, but that'll be a conversation for the future. But so far, it seems to be going well. I think you guys are acutely aware of the issues, the space, where do you offer service, those kind of things, and what they're trying to do up there. But as far as what you all have provided for those so far, I think it's going well.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, we are actually 2 minutes ahead still. And we're going to gain a minute because we don't have to change the seating in the front here.
Yeah, Brenda will come up.
Thank you.
We're going to go to our public health department. Frank is also director there, and actually our commissioner.
And director there, commissioner at mental health.
All right.
I get confused too. Sorry.
Brenda Crosby is with him.
Yes, you guys all know Brenda.
And there are no over-target requests.
There are no over-target requests at public health. Anna asked me that question about federal and state impact on state aid for this one.
Yeah.
It'll be a different answer.
Okay, good. Well, no, it's already on the deck, great. So if you want to answer it without me asking.
Okay. So the recommended budget here, you'll see much of the change, both in expenditures and revenues, is related to our mandates accounts, and I'll talk in more detail about those in a minute. We are within target, so again, the growth that you're seeing is mostly related to salary and fringe growth within the department. We did also take on some grants, one for $28,000 and one for $6,000 from planning that were related to water quality monitoring and HABs. You provided target for the $28,000, but you one-time funded the $6,000. We were able to incorporate the $6,000 into our target, so it will be ongoing without you all needing to make any adjustments from there. So getting into a little bit of the detail, so what's going on with the mandates? Just to kind of give an overview of what our mandates are, they are the bulk of them is early intervention and pre-K, which are the services we provide for children with developmental disabilities and delay, and then our medical examiner program. And I'm going to talk about each of them. First off, transportation has gone up. We contract with Bernie Bus to transport the children to their pre-K services. We're mandated to do that. Their prices have gone up a little bit based on the contract. There was a cost of living built in. We have assured that they're going to meet livable wage in this budget. And so we're continually working with them to make sure the kids get there. One thing that's offsetting transportation a little bit this year, but it's causing service costs to go up, Dryden Central School District was approved to open a classroom in their district, which is good for families that are able to go there instead of having to go all the way to Rackers. We were able to work with the Dryden School District to get them to agree to transport those children for a significantly lower rate, similar as what we do with Ithaca City School District. So it's about 8 students that can be in the classroom, so it's not a huge number, but they're already doing the bus runs and have the schedules, and they're going past these houses anyway, so they can do it for a significantly lower cost than Bernie Bus. So that was a positive in the transportation side. Pre-K service providers. I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about where we've been. So for early intervention, we are the service coordinators. So we actually get the evaluation schedules. We work with the providers. We get people set up. We write the plans. We do all of that work for the children. Once they hit 3 and they transition into the pre-K program, we are simply the fiscal authorities, right? So the school districts administer the program. We pay for it. We split the cost with the state. The providers, so we no longer contract with the early intervention providers. You may remember 3 or 4 years ago, the state took that over to much chagrin. So we don't have control over that anymore. But we do control how much we pay the pre-K providers. And the last time that there was any rate change for them was 2013. And only for 2003, I'm sorry, yes, it was a very long time ago, 2003. And some of the things went up a little bit, and some of them went down. So it wasn't even a straight across the board raise. It was more of a trying to shift, you know, the monies that were there. They need more. They need more to keep up with cost of living. It is expensive to come here to Tompkins County. And so we feel like it's time, because of where we are and how our finances are progressing, to give them a raise. And so we did some evaluation, and we were in the bottom third of the counties generally around us and how much we were paying our providers. We are proposing an increase from $60 to $60. $70. So it's a pretty significant increase, but when you think about they haven't had any at all since 2003, it's really right-sizing where we probably should have been going all along. So that will put us in probably the top quarter of the counties in our area, which based on our cost of living is probably more realistic in order to maintain those providers in our community. We also saw an increase in Medicaid for those services 2 years ago. We did not pass any of that along because, quite frankly, we weren't sure how that was going to play out. But now that we've seen it, it's actually there. There will be some Medicaid that supports that increase. I don't have the number. I wanted to tell you the number that costs. I want to say it's $50,000, Brenda. Sorry, give me 1 second. All right, well, Brenda will find that, and then we'll tell you as we continue along. Go ahead.
Ann's got a quick question.
$70 per hour. What was that?
That's per service. They do go to the home and they do physical therapy. Okay. Generally, it's 30 to 45 minutes, plus their travel time and the paperwork that goes along with that, so it's per service. And we'll get the number for you. I apologize, I don't have that at my fingertips. So we feel like that was appropriate. This was the time to get right size for those folks. We're concerned about losing providers, right? If they can get a similar rate or higher rate at surrounding counties where the cost of living is less, they're definitely not going to want to travel into our county for a lower rate. And if they're going to live here and provide those services, we have to reimburse them appropriately. Let's consider it a livable wage conversation there.
Rich had a question.
Frank? No, I was talking about how much. I don't want to slow us down too much, but are they coming to a house and providing this service for $70 or $60 at present? Are they getting another source of payment for this?
No, this is the payment that they get. Yeah. There are classroom settings that the children that we talked about, a new one opening, Dryden Rackers has several classrooms that they provide. So there are other ways for the children to get the services, but for those that are doing the individual therapies, this is for their rate to go and provide that service. Yes, not a lot. So that's the big part of what's going on with the mandates. We split that cost. So that $10 raise is really a $5 cost to the county because we split it with the state, right, in that number. And I apologize, we'll get that number for you on what the cost is. I think it was roughly about $50,000 for that raise across the services. The last piece of it is the medical examiner. You will see that number has gone up, and I've got a lot of questions about does that mean we have more deaths, what's going on. The reality is it's a right sizing of the medical examiner program. You'll remember a couple of years ago we switched from a single primary care doctor that was kind of doing it part-time to a more professional it was professional before, but a more structured by contracting with the pathologist at CMC. So they're doing the autopsies. They're on scene. They have hired a scene investigator. They're working on hiring a second one, which is some of the cost increase that you're seeing. The number of deaths has not increased in the county. What has increased is the number of autopsies. And we believe that is really a right sizing of the program. Now that we have folks that are focused on this, they have seen investigators, we're doing autopsies at the rate that we probably should have been. There are some increased costs related to tests that we're doing because we are running blood tests on all of the ME cases for toxicology whenever it is appropriate. So it is growth in the program, but it is, I believe we were underpaying for many, many years, and this is more right-sizing, getting us into a program that's more appropriate for our community. So that's kind of the influences along the mandates. On the more traditional public health side of things, There's several things that have happened that are kind of influencing the budget this year. First, you may remember last year we were talking about rabies costs were going up, and we weren't sure how we were going to, you know, if we were going to need more monies to address that. We've been able to negotiate with CMC, and we really appreciate them partnering with us to be able to pay the Medicaid rate for rabies when we're sending folks to the hospital, which significantly cuts our costs to provide that program. So that was a really good improvement that occurred this year, and I'm very thankful to CMC and our staff that were able to work that out, Brenda included. We've done some administrative support reorganization, and you'll see in the FTE count that we're going to be down one in 2020. That is due to a retirement and the end of our administrative reorganization that we've been doing in the department. We have this position that will be eliminated is in environmental health, and we knew this retirement was coming, and we had actually been planning for it. We had a project assistant that came through that was really good that moved to an information aide and then tested into an administrative assistant position, and we moved her into environmental health with the understanding that a retirement was going to be coming, and so now that retirement will come before this year is up, and so we're getting to the end of that environmental health reorganization. But we've also done, so just so you're aware that we're not just taking away from environmental health, we did have an information aid position that was connected to our electronic health record project, and thankfully on October 1st we will be going live for public health, so both mental health and public health will be live in the system, and so we're not going to need that information aid position there anymore. So the person that was in that tested into an administrative assistant position that was vacant in children with special care needs. We are moving that information aid position into admin to support our front desk. So if you've been up there, you've either met Chase or Ling Lee, if you've been up there recently, and we had been doing it with one person, and then others had to cover when that person was on lunch or away, and it was pulling from the other divisions. Now having two people there, we don't need coverage from the other divisions, and so it's created more capacity for them, and it also allows us to have a more structured approach to how we handle the front desk. So when they're not sitting there greeting people, answering the phones, Brenda is working with them on finding other projects in the department that they can support us with. So it really is kind of a shifting of things to where we need them in order to most effectively provide service to the community. So ultimately, we are going to be losing that one position, but it is a planned loss over time related to a restructure in the totality of our admin in the department. The increased hours for the public health sanitarian and public health engineer are related to the reduction in the elevated blood lead level that requires us to do a full environmental assessment. So if you remember back to when we were in the throes of the water issue, at 15 micrograms per liter, don't quote me on that.
No, it is 15.
Is it? Okay. I know the number is 15. I always get the micrograms per liter wrong. It's at 15, we would go, a nurse would handle the human side of it and do an investigation, and our environmental health staff would go out and do the environment part. They would look at the home, they would talk about workplace environment, we contract out to have folks come and test the home for lead. That number was 15. At 10, we still did the nursing part, but we didn't do the full environmental part. And then at 5, we did just basic outreach to the family from our nursing division saying, hey, how are things going? Do you have questions? Here's information kind of thing. The state has lowered now to 5 micrograms per liter when we have to do a full environmental assessment. So we did an evaluation, and based off of past history, we only expect that that's going to be about 30 additional cases for us, which is a lot lower than a lot of other counties around the state. There are counties where they're expecting 300 to 400 more additional cases, and so this is a much bigger lift for them. We feel like we've already been doing the nursing part of it because we were ahead of where the state was, so we're going to absorb the nursing part, but there will be additional work for the environmental health part, and so those positions we're proposing to go from 35 to 37 and a half in order to create capacity in order to do that. It's not a large enough number that we would need to get anywhere close to another FTE, and there's specialized training that goes along with doing these investigations, so we already have people that are trained, so it really just makes sense to increase the capacity of those trained people to meet that need. The last thing on here are the two grants from planning that I already spoke about that we have agreed to move over to environmental health. It just seems to make more sense that we're managing those, and planning was they were certainly on board with shifting those responsibilities over to us. And as I said, the water quality monitoring was $29,000. The HABS was $6,000. That was one time that we have absorbed in as target this year. So we will be continuing that without asking for any additional funds. Funding. And then taking you to the full-time equivalents, which I've already talked about, and we don't have any OTRs, so I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions? I had one. Can't help but read in the news all around the country about Lyme disease, measles, Eastern equine encephalitis, temporary paralysis of children. Not to mention rabies, which you mentioned, mm-hmm. and the new state vaccination requirement for school children. Mm-hmm. Or how are we poised to respond to these things should they arise in our county?
I think we're prepared. We have a team of communicable disease experts as well as our environmental health staff that are continually learning and educating themselves about the emerging issues. We do try to get information out pretty consistently about the things that we're facing. We talk a little bit about this every year, that one of the challenges with public health is that if we're doing our job well, you don't really know that we're doing it. And we're preventing stuff from happening, but when those things do happen, we need to be there in order to respond to them. But it's hard to say, I can't just have somebody sitting there waiting for the next emerging thing. So we try to make sure that we have staff educated and available if those things happen, and then we reprioritize as they emerge. And it kind of doubles on Anna's question about where the funding is coming from. It's the opposite with public health, right? Both at the federal level and at the state level, the state continues to limit what we're able to charge state aid for. They continue to add new mandates like the elevated blood lead levels. They did manage to get $9 million more, but they took $5 million of that for themselves to do the regional offices where they're responsible for environmental health and left the rest of it for all of us to fight over. But we can only access it through state aid. And if you remember how state aid works, we get a base grant of $650,000 that pays for 100% of eligible services. Our state aid is like $1.3 million that we get. So the rest of that, they're only paying 36% of the cost. We as the county have to do the rest. So you should know that we are already meeting our base grant. So anytime the state sends us a new mandate that they say, oh, state aid is going to cover it, it's only covering 36 cents of every dollar. And so we are continually advocating in Albany for changes to the base grant. We're advocating for 100% funding for new mandates, at least in the first year, until we can budget for it. We're trying to get them to think about the science of these mandates and make sure that if they're going to reprioritize vital public health funds, that they're doing it for science reasons and not political reasons. There's a lot of components to trying to be prepared for the financial realities of a shrinking environment and being prepared for all of the new and emerging things that we're faced with. I will just add that kind of the integration conversation, not necessarily of the departments, but of the whole health kind of concept, we're hoping that as we're looking at things like social determinants of health and we're beginning to get upstream, we're not seeing the health disparities where, you know, poor folks and people of color are disproportionately affected by some of these things that are coming out, that hopefully we can begin to get upstream. So there is work coming at it from every direction, but we are faced every day with new challenges that we're hoping we're going to be able to meet the need. And we know we will to the best of our ability. We're just trying to get the decision makers to help fortify that foundation so we can be there.
Your staff is getting adequately trained for these possibilities.
Yeah, there is a lot of effort going on around the new emerging things. And through NYSHU, the New York State Association of County Health Officials, we have monthly meetings that staff are able to attend either virtually or in person. And the state comes to those meetings and brings us what they know about these emerging issues and how they go. And we are a partner with the state in trying to be prepared and help them understand how the things that they're talking about their level are actually manifesting in our communities. So I do think staff are getting information that they need. It's never as much as we would like, and it's never as quick as we might want it, particularly on these emerging things, but I think everyone is doing their best to be as prepared as possible.
Anna?
I know I assume you're going to be at NYSAC with us again, or you?
Not next week.
Oh, not next week. No. I know Shauna and I are both on several of the standing committees. Do you have resolutions, or does your association have resolutions in that packet that
yes.
you, can you give us maybe some talking points before we head out on that one?
Sure.
That would
yeah.
be.
We support all of the resolutions that are.
Wonderful. Any talking points would be lovely. To,
yeah.
yeah. Thank you.
Yep.
And Martha.
Frank, when do you take a breath?
Well, I just got back from a 2-week vacation at the end.
Oh, okay, that'll do it.
Yeah, it's there is a lot going on, but I don't do it alone. I am the fortunate one that gets to talk to you about all the great things that are going on, but there's 60-some people at both departments that are doing an amazing job of making sure we're prepared and that we're taking care of the people we need to take care of. So I'm very fortunate to have a great team of people that help.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I do have a question. The space that the CHA was in, mm-hmm. are you folks using that at all?
We are hoping to grow back into that space. No, it is currently not being used. There's been some temporary visitors that have stayed with us over time. It's county space to be used. I do hope that as we continue to talk about this integration of services thing, again, not about the departments, but services, if there's ability to perhaps do some mental health services up there so people in the northeast part of the county don't have to travel so far, and as we continue to grow our maternal and child health program that we're reviewing and some of those other things, that we might be able to ultimately kind of grow back into that space over time. But right now, no, it's not being used. So I kid Jason about it all the time.
Okay.
It's your space, but we would love to keep it.
Is cooperative extension still there, or they moved
no,
back
No, it's
out?
Currently empty. Yeah.
Okay. I heard a story about immigrants, even documented immigrants, in the current climate, not accessing the services that they're eligible for, and that especially hurting kids, and the WIC program was one of those specifically mentioned. Have you seen anything that you can observe, drop off, any change in the people who are coming in, or
I haven't heard anything specifically from our WIC program that they have seen a drop off. I will tell you that we really weren't doing a good job of engaging those people to begin with, and it's a challenge for us. So they weren't coming in large numbers already. And that's a problem for WIC everywhere. This isn't just a new problem. You're talking about coming into what is usually a very government setting to receive services. And even before the current climate, that was troublesome for folks. We do a lot of outreach and effort. We do have satellite clinics that are out in the communities. We come downtown once a week to try to make ourselves accessible to folks. They do have a social media presence now, and they're trying to engage folks that way. We have always struggled with our WIC numbers in general, because in this community we have a large number of childbearing age women that because of their connection to higher education generally aren't having children at the same rate as the rest of the population. So our goal numbers that they want are always really high, and we struggle to achieve those. So there is capacity. It's not that we don't have capacity. It really has been about trying to engage folks, and that population you're describing has been a challenge for a long time.
Thank you.
Henry Granison.
You talked about the medical examiner, which costs were going up, although in my book,
it zeroed out.
So we shifted what used to be non-mandate dollars into mandate, right, Brenda? Yeah. So, but we did that when we made the shift from the part-time doctor into this new program, because the staffing component we generally didn't put in mandates, but because we were shifting to a contracted environment, it made more sense to just move that over to the mandate account.
Consumer services contracts.
Yeah. So there should be a corresponding increase in the...
So account 4014 is the one that has right. been zeroed out. Account 4017 is the mandate account where all the ME expenses are.
All other contract services has gone up.
It is all contract services. So for removals, for forensic labs, and for the ME.
Yeah, it's gone up like $30,000.
Okay. And then the emerging leaders in PH, 4011.
Yeah, so that is the Kresge grant that I've been talking about that Samantha Hilson and I received. That will end, it's supposed to end in November of this year. So it's just funding that is ending that we wouldn't carry over to the next year. It was one-time grant funding. We are asking them for an extension because we're not done with our efforts. So some of it, we will be back at some point to move some of it into 2020 once we know how much it is. But it was one-time funding related to a grant.
Okay. Yes, Anna.
Just a quick follow-up on that one. Do we have, how do I say, have we been doing data collection on the impact of that grant, and do you have already some evidence of the impact that you could report?
No, we do not have data collection because what we've been doing to date has been a lot of leadership development. And what we've just really kicked into is with our consultants, which is the biggest chunk of what we're spending the grant on, is talking about the future of health. And so we're in the midst. We had our first senior leadership retreat last week. We have another one tomorrow, and we're going to have three total. And that's trying to align the leadership of both departments around the integration of services and begin to talk about social determinants of health and how we as departments can bring that into the work that we do and impact it. In the
right, but the grant was for training and education specifically, if I recall correctly, and to design an infrastructure that would incorporate social determinants of health into your system of services. And so I guess that's more what I was referring to is I'm assuming that that will be something that they would be interested to see whether that was successful. Whether you've redesigned the system and is there receptivity or some message that's gone out that says, yeah, we might be having a second round of grants for this and it would be for the implementation of a readjusted program.
So there is not a second round of grants for this. There has been a history of folks that have participated in the Emerging Leaders Programs of having access to other grants that because of the work that we're doing. The grant was for transformation, as you were describing, around social determinants of health and population health strategists. As it's evolved over time, it has come to be a more internal focus, at least with the grant dollars, because we wanted to make sure we as two departments were aligned and kind of understood social determinants and how we might impact them. So after the senior leadership retreat series, then there will be a meeting with our mid-level managers, and then in December we're planning for an all-staff meeting with both departments together for the first time. So we'll have all 130 people in a room together talking about these issues and getting their ideas and thoughts about how to move that forward. And then the last piece of the grant is set aside for strategic planning. So once the decision is made about the two departments, we would then have resources to be able to put a strategic plan in place either way. Either direction as it's decided.
And the hope is that you could potentially use this, though, because of the new adjustment in the way that the state is reimbursing, that this could establish some wraparound services that we could then get reimbursed for, correct?
Yes, because okay. Now you're talking about potentially an organization that can provide a mental health service but can also send a healthy neighborhoods program into the home to look at safety around asthma and other hazards, fire alarms, those kind of things. So those social determinant issues, the causes of health issues, we have a way to actually influence those that another provider might not be able to.
Great. Thank you.
Henry.
This is off topic, but have the opioid numbers changed much in the last year?
Depends on what opioid numbers you're talking about. If we're just talking deaths, which I'll say again is not the best indicator because the number is relatively low, and we did see a reduction in 2018. 2019, the first half of the year, went up a little bit. So 2019 might look more like 2017 in the 20s, low 20s. As far as overdoses that require intervention, those numbers are holding steady. I think what we have found is that the severity of the response to those has the severity of the end of those has reduced because of the ubiquitousness of Narcan, right? And that has certainly had an impact. And then you wrap around that all of the additional services and different types of services we're trying to provide to folks. It is beginning to have an impact. I can't show you numbers that say, yes, look at what we've done yet, because they have not moved that far. But I do believe the investments that we're making will ultimately in the end show that we've made an improvement on the opioid issue.
Thank you.
Okay. We appreciate it. Frank, you were right. We are now 9 minutes over. We appreciate your presentation tonight. We're going to the History Center. And we're going to hold the new director's feet to the fire. Ben Sandberg, welcome.
Good evening. I'm here.
There are two over-target requests here. One has been recommended. The other has not.
Good evening. I'm here with a lot of gratitude. Thank you guys for your time tonight. For those of you who don't know me, I am Benjamin Sandberg, the new Rod Howe. And I am a couple weeks into the position, and so I'm very glad to be here with you all tonight. I also have with me the vice president of our board, Chris Irving, and then also Rich John, who is also a member of our board. Year over year, piece in the budget has stayed pretty steady. You'll see a slight increase, and most of that increase for us is to help support a little bit more for our bookkeeping service on account of taking on the new position within the Tompkins Center for History and Culture on the Common, which you guys were instrumental in helping facilitate, and it has allowed us to professionalize some of our internal bookkeeping services. But that has been, you know, nothing unexpected there. Obviously, the major influences for us are our new home on the Commons. It really has been a significant paradigm shift for our organization. It was only made possible thanks to the hard work of the legislature here, but also just an incredible amount of community partners. For us as the History Center, from where we were a year ago, 3 years ago, to where we are now, it really has opened up a lot of doors for us. We're seeing, you know, previously we would look at visitor numbers in tens and hundreds, and it's an order of magnitude bigger. And so now counting visitors in terms of thousands of people through the door. For a History Center, you guys may not know general statistics in America for museums and history centers, but there is a general decline, and to all of a sudden be in a space where we are seeing huge upticks, it is really transformational for us. Historically, your support has assisted with rent. That has been the big chunk of it, both for our public exhibition spaces, but then also where we store collections, manage collections. And the new space really has improved our ability to take care and intake items. You will see that first OTR is to help with some more off-site collection space for us. That middle bullet point, you can see we moved from roughly 3,500 square feet to around 1,900 square feet in terms of square footage dedicated to our collections. The recommended OTR of 10,000 will help accommodate the rest of our collections, specifically it will help enable active care and maintenance. I think there's this general perception of collections work as being a passive experience, and it really is, in this case, a very ongoing, labor-intensive work experience for us.
Mike?
Question?
Kevin?
I'm sorry, I was just reading up there. Kevin?
It's worth mentioning that the recommended budget recommends the OTR as one time. It was requested as target funding. It's recommended as one time. We have an error on the slide.
Thank you for that.
Oh, you're fine. And then the OTR that was not recommended was, this again was a one-time, it was, I think, initially made in acknowledgement of the History Center's role within the larger Tompkins Center for History and Culture. A lot of some of the administrative work around the building flows down by nature of the collaborative, nature of the building. There's no staff. It is sort of the work is done through the coming together of all of our partners, and the History Center is the most present there, given that we have increased our hours from sort of open partially for 3 days, where we are now open full time 6 days a week, and by nature of that, a lot of the sort of day-to-day work that goes into the TCHC falls sort of to the History Center. Even a nominal amount would go a long ways, but this was not part of the recommended budget, and we are incredibly appreciative for the $10,000 that was included in the recommended budget.
Anna?
A few questions about the storage.
Yep.
How often are these, well, I guess, like, give us a sense of how many collections there are, how often they're rotated through, how often a collection is used before it's permanently retired.
Sure.
Give us a sense.
Yeah, so in our collections, we have over 130,000 pieces, and it's a combination from archival materials, postcards, newspapers, magazines, yearbooks, to three-dimensional objects. I think one of my favorites is our plow from the 19th century. And then we have an incredible collection of glass plate negatives. It's one of the most extensive, and textiles as well. And in terms of management of those stuff, so I'll use the textiles as a way to highlight it. We have a pretty strong group of volunteers that come in and do work with our textiles every week. And so in terms of repair to textiles, in terms of developing new exhibits with them, it is weekly work that goes on with those.
So if this were made as a one-time instead of target, you would rent a space for a year with this funding, and in the interim look for funding that isn't from the county to permanently create
Yes.
that storage?
Yes. So our plan is the storage space that we are acquiring off-site, that is a long-time home, and specifically that storage will be our textiles, our glass plate negatives, some of the archival materials, and a couple of the three-dimensional collections. And so, you know, for instance, we're writing a grant right now that is a private family foundation in New York who wants to fund improvement and support for textile collections in upstate New York. I know, incredibly specific, but it's this one family and an artist who really loved textile works. Yes.
Lovely.
And that is in the range of 50 to 100,000. It also includes a public component. So in terms of engaging audiences, working with artists to create artwork inspired by textiles. And so we are submitting that in 2.5, what's the date today? Beginning of October.
I encourage connecting with Cornell's Human Ecology.
Yes, yep, absolutely. because they have a pretty incredible textile collection as well.
Pretty much. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question.
Thank you.
Hi there. Thank you for coming today.
Of course.
I was wondering, and perhaps you don't know this answer.
Might be.
Did we do a one-time funding for storage last year for the History Center?
I don't know off the top of my head. It might have been, instead of storage, it might have been moving costs associated with, we did, in the transition from the old space and into the new space, we did have to go out to a private and temperature climate controlled storage space for some of our stuff, so it might have been in relation to that. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay. And then if you were to get the grant funding, would you still need county funding?
For
next year
at all?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So that the
for this OTR specifically.
Oh, the OTR. Oh, no. No, and that's not the only source we're looking at for that OTR. So, you know, I don't want to predict the future, but absolutely I think we would like to get back to just the recommended line instead of going after OTRs for the same thing. I think we definitely acknowledge that part of the paradigm shift is sort of adjusting to some of our new space and the new costs associated with that. And so getting the time to identify and go after those other sources is incredibly helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Let's go to Rich next.
Yeah.
Then Martha, then Henry.
Shauna, I can actually answer your question there, that last year in the general rent that the county paid for the History Center, it was a blended rate in the Gateway building for the museum space, but also there was a storage area downstairs. And so there was a single per square foot charge, but it covered both areas. And I don't know if everything's out of there yet.
So I can, yeah, so we are almost completely out of our storage with Nagley, which is down in Elmira and sort of the quality for storing museum collections items. We'll be completely out of there by the end of September. And then we are still arranging and creating the most efficient storage for our collection use on site and in our new space. That should also be completed by the beginning of October, and so our goal is to get out of Gateway by the end of October, which will take down, you know, some of our overall rent costs.
Thank you.
So we were paying storage charges. It's been quite a year in terms of moving the collection around, but I wanted to say the town of Ithaca has actually been pretty good at providing conditioned space in their building at a very good rate. And that should be a long-term home for the collection, so, including in the center itself.
Yes, yeah. And that is one of the challenges for us in terms of care for the condition is, you know, there are, you can't stick them in any old basement somewhere, that there has to be, you know, certain requirements to ensure the long-term longevity of those pieces.
Great. Thank you.
Of course.
We do have long-term storage for our records in the nuclear bunkers.
Are you offering that space?
People
that's something we can put on the record
about them. So let's go to Martha next.
Well, the bunkers in Seneca County, I guess, and Elmira, those are not that convenient. It sounds like the town of Ithaca basement is a lot more convenient. Welcome, Ben. It's good to meet
you.
I walked up by you over there. I, like, didn't register who you were. So, hello. Welcome, and we're glad that you're here. Can you tell me, you're now open many, many more hours than you were. What's your staffing like now?
That is one of the challenges for us in adjusting to what day-to-day operations looks like given the new shift for us. So we have a full-time curator, archivist, marketing and docent volunteer manager, director of youth education, bookkeeper, and then myself as well.
Is that five people?
Six, but we split our bookkeeper with Historic Ithaca.
Okay. You said docent volunteers. Is that you have volunteered docents on the floor
who are manning the desk and will do tours inside the space. We will sort of do special programming for tours and that kind of stuff, and often that will be staff leading it. But in terms of day-to-day, and so part of the marketing and docent training position includes regular docent training, both sort of museum-specific, but also being a public interface, so arranging Narcan training. I know you guys were just talking about that, but given that we are now in such a prominent public space, the expectations of what our docents can handle, and that actually stemmed from the ground up. It was a thing that docents were eager to learn and it, to better fulfill their role working with the public and being ambassadors for our organization. It has been so incredible to get to know our group and our base of volunteers and docents. We, as an organization, are incredibly blessed with the folks that we have sort of volunteering both as face-to-face, doing archival work in the library. It's really incredible to see the community support for that.
Well, I'm really impressed with what's happened there. The exhibits are spectacular, and congratulations and good luck.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Henry.
My question's already been asked.
Okay. I wondered how the whole center has been working together. It's a new experiment for the county, something that had been requested for a long, long time, which was to have some space for some of the small not-for-profits. And I wonder, now that we've got everybody in there, are they working together?
So again, I'm 3 weeks in, so I will speak somewhat from my past experience and what I have sort of discovered in those 3 weeks, and that is that getting, and this is I will acknowledge, hard to quantify, but there is a special synergy that happens when you get creative minds together, and everybody in those organizations, whether they think it or not, is programming creatively, they're doing creative work, and trying to find new ways to engage the public around what I think are really incredibly important pieces of our life here in Tompkins County. And so, you know, today to be able to walk down to Susan Holland and have a conversation about some of the haunted history tours and their cemetery tours and find a way to develop that programming in conjunction with each other instead of having sort of similar programs running at the same time, maybe competing with each other, maybe not. But so now, you know, we're hoping to be able to put forward something where those programs are working together. Having the Discovery Trail in the same suite as us is incredible. Our biggest collection piece is the 8-square schoolhouse out near Dryden, that is technically a part of our collection, and it is one of the sites on the Discovery Trail. And to have Beth, if you haven't had a chance to meet her, I would absolutely encourage you to do so. I think she has done phenomenal and has such great ideas for the Discovery Trail and Kids Discover the Trail. And to have her in the same office, to be able to go over and talk through creative ideas. I think we're going to see a lot of new things coming out of that space. Another example would be, I think my first week, the folks over at Discover Cayuga Lake came over and were like, hey, can you come and do a sort of history of the lake on one of our boat cruises? And I thank goodness for Donna. She gave me some talking points. I skimmed and read through some books and was able to go talk about folklore on the lake, and which I talk to me about folklore sometime, and I'll take up more than I think the 10 minutes I have gone over.
Well, we'll take you up on that some.
Okay.
Anyone else? Ben, thank you very much for coming in tonight.
Absolutely. A quick plug, a week from Saturday, we found Amelia Earhart. She's doing all right, and she'll be at the History Center talking about the history of aviation in Tompkins County.
Oh. All right. I'm going to suggest that we take our and then at 7:32, we will come back and take information technology rather than the break in the middle of their presentation. Sorry, Craig, Lauren, but I think it works better that way.
crunch for the
morning. Okay, we're back, and now we have information technology. And we have, Rich.
Just, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Michelle has just let me know that public safety, all the members are able to meet at 2:30 next week, and I wanted to make sure the full legislature knew because we'll be considering that resolution regarding hunting and rifles, and I know there's some interest with it. So 2:30 instead of 3:30 next Thursday.
Okay. So back to Greg Potter and Lauren Cottrell about our information technology department.
Greg said he was going to do it in 5 minutes, Mike.
happy to have that happen, except he has four over-target requests, all of which have been recommended.
Right.
Greg, go ahead.
So with me this evening is Lauren Cottrell. Most, if not all of you, know him, so I just wanted to introduce Lauren first. So let me just start with the basics here. On the expenditures line item, we went from an increase primarily due to the OTRs that hopefully you would look at and I'll review and approve. One of those is pretty substantial, and that's regarding succession planning as a one-time OTR, similar to what we did last year regarding our retirement that is going to happen in 2020. So we had the same scenario in 2019 or this year. And then we've had some additional increases in contracts or services, of which we've got about 35 vendors that are under contract with us right now. The revenues line item increased by about $13,000 partially. That is due to the one-time rollover use that we are using to hopefully balance the more of the budget for 2020 from 2018 rollover. And in addition, we signed this year an MOU with the Healthcare Consortium, our health insurance consortium, and provide their IT support and services and work with them this year to relocate their office at a space in the town of Ithaca. So we did a lot of work with them, but that's the ongoing cost for our MOU with them. The difference then at the bottom is leads to a 2.8% increase from last year, having said that. Okay. So the major influences, there are many. We've just tried to keep the list short here. But starting at the top for us is similar to last year, succession planning. Our network administrator, who has been with us for over 30 years or about 30 years, is retiring in June. So we've got plans in place to reorganize and shift people around to beef that up. That's the one-time OTR for salary and fringes bumps up, hopefully, a person in our office that's been with us for over 10 years to that position that we've been talking about and working on to that title, working directly at that same title that this person is currently in, the one that's going to retire, to learn the position as close as possible before the retirement happens. So, and then underfilling and reorganizing from there across the department. The second item there, there's two capital projects. One, the capital project that has been in existence, that's the HR payroll time and attendance and 24/7 public safety scheduling. So those are all kind of related. What's new this year that we're working on right now is the migration of our time and attendance solution to a new one, which is from a company called Kronos. And in addition, at the same time, we're rolling out a new scheduling software module from the same company that works for the 24/7 operations from public safety. So there's road patrol, corrections, airport ops, and the dispatch center. After that is all done, then we're going to reevaluate how we use HR payroll and possibly looking at migrating that to the cloud as well. So those two previous applications that I talked about are hosted by the company, not in our data center, which is a big benefit for us in the world of IT. The second capital project is a new initiative and a new approach to county government in the way that we manage and pay for and plan for the replacement of IT infrastructure across the county. So in the past, we've relied on contingency funds, emergency requests, grants, one-time OTRs. So in working with Jason, we've developed a five-year incremental plan to replace all the core equipment as it needs to occur. So this would be the first year that we would implement that structure. The first two big projects for next year is the replacement of the core networking switches on the county, the majority of which are going on 6 to 8 years of age. So there's a mandate to replace those. And what has become an increasingly critical and important piece of operations in the county is the video security system. So that is also in need of replacement and upgrade and revise the way in which we manage the structure of that infrastructure and the technology behind the video cameras across the county. So that's another big piece. We've got the county website project, which the Governmental Operation Committee is fully aware of that. So that's a migration from what we're on, which is Drupal 8 to Drupal 7 to Drupal 8. And so we've migrated the core part of the county's website and the portal pages and the home pages for all the departments. Now we're working on the migration for the incremental, the departmental stuff, and working with departments to train them. At the same time, we're using another tool called Site Improve to evaluate and provide some guidance as we migrate so we can review how those sites are accessed or used or what links are broken or how they may hold up to all the new compliance requirements that are coming down from the federal government. So that's a one-time project that are implementing now. To provide the report and analysis to help us and the departments as we migrate from 7 to 8 and in the future as we migrate or maintain what we have in 8. Census 2020, many of you are familiar with that, so we're involved with the full count committee and then gearing up in the future for the reapportionment project, which is related to that and partially related to the address updates that we've recently and ongoing submitted to the Census Bureau for corrections to addresses. So there's a little more work to do there in identifying all the new construction in Tompkins County to feed into the Census 2020 project so the information goes to the right places or now to the right places. The next one is fairly substantial for us. Board of Elections, there's a lot of effort going on across New York State and the federal level that involves cybersecurity and compliance around Board of Elections operations. In New York State, and I don't know if it's the same in other states, it's very difficult to exclude BOE from the rest of the IT requirements and infrastructure at the county level. And so that whole BOE project, the state level, in coordination with the state IT directors at our level, has been jointly discussed in how they're best to roll it out, and that's included IT very closely. So we're benefiting in many ways from the cybersecurity practices that are rolling out through BOE. It's been actually a good project. We were a bit concerned about it at first, but it's been beneficial to us, and there's two major projects that we're working on directly with the consultants that BOE at the state level is hired to implement. One we just finished up yesterday. Electronic poll books is the other big thing that's going to hit us, and so we've been working with Board of Elections. Although those electronic poll books and the technology won't actually be hosted by us, we're involved in helping them to manage the technology in the field and test out the technology once they get the devices to the polling places and testing out internet connectivity. So there's a lot to that. And managing how that works in every polling place and getting the workers to understand how to use technology is going to be a big part of that. The last item on there is LaserFiche. This is a project that we started years ago, about 8 years ago, with the county clerk's office internally for county departments. It's grown into a much larger project for shared services with other municipalities, but more importantly these days, it's become a critical back-end electronic business process system that a lot of departments are now relying on, or users of LaserFish that are in the shared services world. So we're now discussing how to sustain LaserFish as we move forward, as it grows, as it becomes more successful, because the model that we have right now is not going to do it. It's not going to cut it. It's a great project. There's a lot of advantages to using it. We're just trying to find the right balance between how to support it properly in the future, and I think that's going to be our focus over the next year. Okay. So FTEs is staying the same. The halftime position is the one-time OTR that I mentioned for succession planning, as we did last year. But on average, or in the past, we have about 12 FTEs across the department. OTRs. So let me start at the top. The first one is regarding a piece of software. So the evolution of software that is used in reinforcement has changed, and this is the first year that we're looking at and suggesting that we invest the money into new software to help us through the process of reinforcement. We know that won't kick into 2021, but we would like to get a start on that software and learning the software towards the end of 2020 and be ready to respond to the 2021 initiative. So that's what that $4,500 is. And that would be covered entirely by the rollover. So we took what we had available for rollover, and we just applied it incrementally from the priorities on down. The next line item down is for the one-time money for succession planning that I mentioned. Again, balanced out between what was remaining in the rollover and what we're asking for in additional money for one-time. And that's salary and fringes. The next line item is data conversion software. So we spend a lot of time between systems and trying to get data migrated from one system to another. In particular, in the world of GIS, there's at least three or four systems that we have to move address information into on a regular basis. And so what this data conversion software does is it allows us to design templates to create a template for each conversion project we have to do, so we don't have to manually do the work to get the data from one place to another. So it's something that sits in between. So for the incremental cost of, you know, $2,750 with an ongoing cost of $600 for support of the software, it was worth its expenditure just in time alone. The last piece is the one-time money that I talked about for the Site Improve software for the future of the management of the data on our website and the migration as it occurs. So we did an analysis of how long it would take to review all the pages on the website and get from version 7 to 7 to 8, and it's a lot of time and working with the departments. So this software would better focus on what improvements or whether a certain page would have to be forwarded to the new site, since nobody has looked at the page in 3 years, for instance. So there's probably a quarter of the county web pages or data that's out there that hasn't been looked at or touched in over 3 years. So it helps us quite a bit to simplify the website. Okay, that's up and go back three. I'll open it up to questions.
Questions? Martha.
Hi, Greg. I got to confess, it's like I can't imagine doing your job. So I was on that last one. So how much is there going to be a redesign of the website, or is this just kind of cleaning up?
It's a complete redesign of the website. It looks very similar. It's the same software, the same company that's hosting for us, but we've simplified it as a great deal and done it in a way that works on the mobile platform as well.
Right. Okay. So, but just the sort of the graphic look of it. I mean, it's going to look different.
Yeah.
Okay.
But not much. I mean, it's all the same color scheme.
you know, the homepage would be rotating banners. I mean, so we instead of all the busyness on the homepage, we're really trying to simplify that as much as possible and bring forward just what the user needs in a more accurate way.
Okay. I hope, like the rest of us who aren't on the actual committee, you know, we'll at least get a look at this at some point while it's in process for feedback. Is that?
That was not the plan.
Actually, Dan gave us an option to do that like 6 months ago.
Yes, we did reach out. We sent out everything okay. to all the members. We started with Yo and sent out the request to invite everyone to participate and to respond
okay.
to what was submitted, and we got no responses.
Martha, you said you liked it.
Right. You said
you liked it a lot.
I wanted to. I okay. Time.
All right. Okay. All right. Okay. That's fine. Well, so my question, though, was sometimes something that hasn't been touched for 3 years, you still want to go back. Is there going to be a way to archive historical stuff?
Yeah, we're going to look at if there's a need to archive something, then we would hope to do it, but in a different system or a different way to do it.
I literally look for budget information from a couple years ago.
Right.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
We need to have 12 years of budget information out there is the question, right? Which we do now.
Oh, okay. Got it. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Amanda.
Thank you both for everything you do. My question is about the last OTR, and you looks like you put it in for Target, but it's being recommended as one time, and just why, or is it going to be an ongoing thing that you need?
Well, we're not sure. We want to make sure it's going to work for us, and we weren't quite sure we were going to commit to that for an ongoing project.
Okay.
And so Jason and I had some discussions about it. Initially, we thought about it as a target, but, you know, to look at it 1 year and then make a decision afterwards. And by the time it comes down to it, you know, we'll see where our costs are for professional services. We always play this game every year where we give up some professional services, we take on others, and so there's a balancing act on professional services that we do every year.
Thanks.
Anna?
That was part of my question. The other half of that, I was just curious because I've worked with Drupal before, and it's obviously the most flexible of all the platforms,
yes.
Which is amazing, but it also then requires a significantly higher amount of base knowledge to interface with it rather than some of the other platforms. And I was curious, have you looked at engaging or, you know, working with any? I know it would be a huge transition. I ask also, do we have all staff internally who know or enough staff internally that work with Drupal, or do we outsource that because of how difficult it can be?
So internally, there's a person in my staff who half her job might just be with helping people with the web content management in their sites.
Mm-hmm.
At each department, then we've got an account, at least one set up, and they manage their own content. So we've got 50 content managers across the county, like
yeah.
Cornell may do. So Cornell is on the same platform.
And they all then have training in that.
Right. And so the site improve concept is that in order to standardize everything across the website, we can give back or feedback to the content managers what is not working or what is out of compliance, and so they can fix it themselves. Right. That's the idea behind that.
Thanks.
Other questions? Another one, Martha.
Yeah, cybersecurity. I keep hearing stories about ransomware and
sure.
cities and counties that get attacked. Can you make us feel better? I mean, what?
Feel better, sure. I gave a report to GEO, I think it was last week.
Yes.
And kind of went over what's been going on close by with ransomware, Lansing schools, Syracuse schools, other counties. And I think the bottom line was we're doing more training, more cybersecurity training in departments. For example, I was in finance this morning doing a...
That was excellent.
Thank you.
I had a lot of comments from the staff. We learned about phishing and spoofing and spear phishing and snorkeling and scuba diving. And
see? He was listening.
Partially. It was great.
So,
every department should have them come in for that.
Yeah.
And I've probably made made it through probably half to three quarters of the counties or the county and departments. We're doing new employee safety or tacking on to the new employee safety orientation. So new employees will come to their HR orientation, and within that month they go to a second orientation, which we've tied cybersecurity to. So we're getting people on the way in. I'm trying to do a push to get all of the existing workforce at least gone through one of my trainings, including the legislature at some point. And then we'll look at next year and how we'll continue to do the updates or yearly trainings. So I think education and cybersecurity, I think users are our workforce is our biggest risk when it comes to ransomware and those issues. Like Greg mentioned, the initiatives from BOE that are filtering down are huge for us. We've now got tools that, quite frankly, I don't think we would have been able to afford before. So like Greg mentioned, we just implemented some logging tools this week that are being monitored 24/7, 365. So now we have two vendors that are kind of looking over us all the time, and then calling Greg and I when there's issues, middle of the night, whenever. So we'll continue to build on those resources. Hopefully, we'll continue to get more help from the state and federal government. It can literally be a full-time job for multiple people to keep us safe.
Thank you. I do feel better. Thank you.
Good. Go ahead.
Anyone else? Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
We're now about a half an hour behind. That's all right. We've had our break.
Can we just like acknowledge we're always going to be a half an hour behind and reassess how much time we give you all? We just like
find you.
John. John Nagley, Soil and Water Conservation Service, Tompkins County.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you.
John has two over-target requests which have not been recommended.
All right. Well, I will try to be quick. I have 20 slides, so I will breeze through this real quick. Here we go. So the recommended budget is $251,913 for 2020. That's a 2% increase from last year's target request. Like Mike had mentioned, there's two over-target requests. They're not supported by the recommended budget. The first is $130,000 for a water resource engineer. We have a part-time, less than 20-hour a week engineer on staff now that does most of our stream bank stabilization certifications for us. And what we're hoping to do is transition that person. He's probably got another 2 or 3 years realistically with the district. Transition that person into a full-time position once he leaves the district. He's a retired engineer from Delaware County Soil and Water District that we've had the pleasure to have on staff with us, and has a lot of knowledge that could transfer over into a full-time engineer. This full-time engineer that we're requesting would be not only stream bank stabilization projects, but also filter over onto our ag program, be able to hopefully certify some of those ag projects too. We also have another OTR request for a ag conservation technician partially funded by state funding. And then the other 50% approximately would be outreach coordinator for agriculture and just general soil and water district functions. So the 50% of that would be the $35,000 asked to the county. But that is a number two priority. The engineer is our number one priority. So I'm going to focus most of my presentation on that. Right now, we work with, under New York State law, education law, for all of our projects that require engineering, and we work within the Natural Resource Conservation Service guidelines for best management practices. And there's a lot of legal requirements that need professional engineering on our projects. And so NRCS is pretty strict with their programs and how they filter that down into our standards and specifications that non-NRCS employees, and that include soil and water districts, only have the authority to go out and inspect a project, do inventory and evaluation. There are some job approval authorities that NRCS has put together that we can go out and put on, like riparian buffers, plant some trees. And this is kind of the list of those non-engineering functions that current staff can do that don't have a PE license. So it's pretty limited, you know. Like I said, some tree planting, some fencing, maybe some gutters and downspouts, some concrete pads for heavy use protection areas around barnyards. But when you, and this is just kind of some pictures of those, cover crops, which is a big push, trying to get those on ag fields. So as you go around the county, you'll be starting to see some cover cropping signs, so look for those on roadsides. But once you get into the engineering position, this is the list of functions that an engineer can sign off and practices that an engineer can sign off on. So we would have to go out either to a private engineer to do that, or if we had an engineer on staff, we could sign off on those in-house. And the list continues of things that we're not able to do other than going out to a private engineer. And that just slows our projects down. And as we have to wait for a certification from a private engineer, within the ag realm, there are two private engineers that can do like waste storage structures within a 5 to 8 county region. So you can imagine the backlog that's happening for implementing some of these practices. Stream bank stabilization that we do a lot of, same issue. There's just not enough in the private sector that have the knowledge and skills that we could develop with a engineer on staff in the district. Just another couple pictures of projects that we've worked with private engineers, so like nutrient management structures, waste storage structures, stream bank stabilization. These are all high-profile projects that really reduce sediment contribution, nutrient runoff into our streams, lakes, water bodies, and improve soil and water quality. So what are some of the projects that we have going on that require an engineer? Right now we have three CAFO waste storage grants and two ag non-point source grants that are, for a total of five, that are waste storage structures. So we're in the, it's about $1.5 to $2 million worth of implementation funding for those types of structures. And we have to carve out of that those grants private engineering funds. As you see there, $73,500, $22,500. That could go towards implementation, cut down the cost share for the farm that's implementing, put more BMPs on the ground. FLOPA contracts, the same idea, just smaller scale, maybe a roof structure over a barnyard. our Cayuga Inlet Sediment Assessment with New York State DEC funding. We have $50,000 that will extend our current engineer, our part-time engineer, into 2021. So that's kind of helping our transition plan to be able to fund him and then maybe provide some training as we have a full-time staff member on board to transition into a full-time person. Also, we work with municipalities for stormwater pollution and prevention plan reviews, and if there's, say, a retention basin on one of those plans that are being reviewed, that's an engineering structure. We can't review that with our CPESC licenses, our Certified Professional Erosion Control licenses. We have to have a professional engineer review those. So that's probably about another $5,000 annually that we use from the Stormwater Coalition dues to go out to a private engineer. And so those are, you know, some of the hurdles that we have within the district trying to implement projects. We have a lot of statewide priorities from New York State DEC, New York State Ag and Markets, that are kind of coming to fruition through TMDLs, HABs action plans, nine element plans that are saying soil and water districts are the go-to agency to be able to implement BMPs, but they don't have the staffing to do that. And you can see the list. This is the Cayuga Lake HABs action plan that came out in 2017, 18 now. And probably 50% of the listing here of practices require a PE stamp. So it's stuff that we would need to go out to a private PE. Our existing staff could do the majority of the work, but then we would have to wait for the PE review from a private engineer planner on that. And even in those HABs action plans, it states the increased soil and water district staffing through appropriations, planners, engineers, and technical staff, implementing more of our AEM program through 3A resource management plans and nutrient management plans. So the question is, okay, well, the state has requested all of this through the HABs action plans. Where's the funding? I get asked this question a lot. Where is that $65 million of HAB funding from the governor? That's a good question. I don't have a great answer for it. I've asked repeatedly to representatives at Ag and Markets and DEC. The answer I always get is it's funneling through existing programs in the Environmental Protection Fund. So, you know, that's kind of our bread and butter for districts, for state funding, is the Environmental Protection Fund. This past year, it was funded at $300 million for the entire state. Districts get our state aids through what we call a Part A for staff salaries, so that's about $60,000. We also get AEM, our Ag Environmental Management Program funding, and that's about $65,000 per year for staff related to that program. So they have to be working under the Ag AEM program. A lot of the other funding mechanisms that we have through the Environmental Protection Fund are competitive. We're fighting with other soil and water districts, other municipalities, other agencies for some of those funding sources and their implementation projects. They want to see things going on the ground. They don't like to see a lot of the staff time devoted to that. We can do that. That's totally legitimate within the grant funding sources, but it just carves out from that grant and either increases cost shares. You know, usually there's 25% cost share to grants, or just decreases the amount of BMPs we can do. So here again, New York State DEC funding, FLOPA, Finger Lakes Lake Ontario Watershed Protection Alliance funding. Again, competitive reimbursement. We kind of solved the reimbursement issue with funding from the county. We get $200,000 annually from the county, which gives us a little bit of a buffer when we're doing projects to be able to upfront pay for some of those projects. So the EPF is a little volatile, and putting a staff person to the EPF fund is nerve-wracking. This is kind of a record from the State Comptroller's Office of appropriations for the EPF fund, that red line. And the blue line is expenses and disbursements from the EPF fund. And so you can see some pretty big spikes there. 2008, we had the recession, so that fund got robbed a little bit for balancing the state budget. And so we're seeing another spike back up to $300 million. We're skeptical throughout the districts of, is that going to last, or is this just a sugar spike that's going to, again, crash? We keep hearing it's legit. Let's go with it. It's going to take a few more years to I think see that disbursement line, that blue line, come up to where expenses are meeting that $300 million. So it's volatile, I guess, is the point of this slide. So that's kind of the state side of things. Within our own county, watershed priorities, we have three different watersheds. We have the Cuba Lake Watershed, Wasco Lake Watershed, and the Chesapeake Bay Watershed, which all have their recommended action plans, restoration protection plans. And I'm not going to go through all of this, but the point is they're looking at implementation and looking at soil and water districts to be implementers of the action plans. So, you know, here's the Owasco Watershed Management Plan, and I urge everybody to, you can find these online. Go online, just Google Owasco Lake Watershed Management Plan. It's with Cayuga County, our Cayuga Lake Watershed Restoration Protection Plan. They're great plans. It just needs funding behind these plans. And even in the Chesapeake Bay Watershed Implementation Plan, it again states the need for technicians, private planners, and engineers to soil and water districts. So this is just language taken right out of those plans. Our current staff, we have five full-time staff people. Three of those staff people are technical. One is strictly related to ag implementation. We have a conservation assistant that kind of splits their time between the ag program and municipal stream bank stabilization type projects, and then one that's strictly doing those municipal stream bank stabilization, like Drilla, whatever, anything else comes up that we need. And then our part-time engineer that I've talked about. So I haven't touched on the outreach component. You know, I know this is a pretty big ask. So obviously the engineer is what we're really focusing on, but there are some needs that, you know, existing staff were stretched thin. We're not meeting these needs that getting information out to the public of, hey, there's grant programs. Hey, municipal leaders, you can reach out to soil and water districts or the planning department, or, you know, there's maybe I just sent out a reforestation plan grant program to a couple of you, and those types of things where we see it and we just don't have the staff to be able to pump it out to the right people. So with that, I'm going to open it up to questions and let people fire away.
Thank you, John. Let's go to Amanda.
Great. Thank you so much for all of this and for really spelling out, you know, why this position is important. So Deborah Dawson is actually watching us right now, and she sent me a couple questions, but I think that you kind of answered them, but maybe you could just go a little bit further. You know, we've talked about HABs quite a bit. John and I both serve on a subcommittee of the Water Resources Council that is focused solely on HABs. And so this engineer, are there certain grants that if you had this person in place, you could only get? And then I guess the second part of that is that how would that help influence or change our issues with HABs?
Yeah, so I think kind of what I've spoken to in the presentation, there's not necessarily grants that we're locked out of. It's a matter of those grants need that PE certification, and we're doing it right now. We're going out to private engineer firms. It's just a matter of it could delay the project by 6-8 months waiting for those private engineers to sign off. And we need, I mean, you saw the HABs action plan. There's goals in there that are 1 to 3 years. So we're looking to implement in our construction seasons, even like on stream stabilization projects, we are limited to a June to September 30th construction window. Because of trout habitat, fish habitat. So there's a lot of environmental concerns. There's a lot of environmental permits that we have to work through. So, you know, a 6 to 8 month review just for a PE, that may set us back 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah. And then, thank you. And then the other question is, I think you also kind of alluded to this, but that primarily, the state is looking to soil and water districts to deal with the HABs action plan. And, I mean, they're not saying, oh, we're going to turn it over to environmental health. They're really looking to you to deal with this stuff, right?
Yeah, the watershed implementation projects, they because soil and water districts have state law where we can go out onto private property and be able to do projects that municipalities it's a little awkward for them to do. We're able to go out onto farms, out onto a private landowner and implement projects that affect the watershed rather than maybe just within a right-of-way of a municipality.
Okay. Great, thank you.
Okay, I have Shauna, Anna, Ann, Henry, Martha.
Wow. You're popular.
So mine will be quick. Word has it that you're the guru on grants. But I was wondering, and I've also looked at your financials over the past few years and seen that you've been very successful. So good work on that. I was wondering if, in fact, the water resource engineer position was funded, do you foresee us being able to recoup the cost of the $130,000 in grant funding for that position per year?
There are state funding sources that we could possibly tap into. But like I said, that EPF volatility, it doesn't make it so that I can go out to a engineer and say, hey, I'm going to have a position for you for the rest of your career or, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road. I can say, well, 3 years down the road, I have a pretty good idea. So to answer your question, yes, there are some possibilities to be able to, in the short term, maybe fill some gaps in.
Sure. So that's why you asked for Target?
Yeah.
So that we could recruit someone, and knowing that they would be with our county and it's not just a one-time?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Anna?
One of the things that Glenn and I were both looking at, I appreciated because I had the same question that Shauna had, and then I was looking at the current project list requiring engineer, and it seems like the amount of money that could go to programming that is now going to an engineer in and of itself is almost like 130. So at least it would provide 130 more towards programming that currently isn't, and that was very, very helpful. The one thing that I'm seeing as well, you know, a lot of us are really concerned about climate change and feeling the crunch of time right now given reports that have recently come out. And one of the greatest contributors to climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, obviously, is agriculture, particularly in our county. It's been estimated to be very high. And it seems like your agency is one of the only ones that can address some of these issues for us. So I'd love for you to talk to me a little bit about some of the ways that, you know, doing this, these positions might help that. In particular, you put the comments about cover crops, but like training on no-tillage, other carbon farming techniques. If you could just speak a little bit about that possibility.
Yeah. So I'll kind of go back to some of the standards and specs here. So there are a lot of different BMPs that we can put on the landscape. So say we have a waste storage structure, you know, that's releasing methane. There are grant programs that we can do waste storage covers and flare systems right now, mm-hmm. And convert that methane into a CO2 form. It's one step closer to doing like a methane digester. Mm-hmm. You know, so we kind of have to step into that a little bit. There's projects like denitrifying bioreactors at the end of tile lines. You know, there's a whole host of, and you talked about soil health practices with no-till systems, cover cropping. So, like I said, we are working with a lot of farmers now. We have an Eastern Finger Lakes cover crop grant that we're working with them to be able to purchase the seed. And then we're also looking at equipment purchases that we can work with them on. Those practices don't really necessarily need an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the bigger systems.
The biodigesters and the no flare.
Yeah.
Got it. Great.
And
My questions are mostly answered, and I'm also very concerned about floods and HABs, and I'll save the rest for when we talk more about the budget later.
Henry?
Yes, my question was mostly asked by Anna, but I'm still just trying to make sure that I understand that under required engineering projects, that those are funds that you outlay anyway, right?
So those are funds that, you know, if it requires an engineer,
right.
We're going out to a private engineering firm to have them do the engineering. Sometimes we can... existing staff will get to a point where we can hand it off to an engineer, maybe cut down some of that time, but it's really a time saver for us to be able to have that engineer on staff.
So it's time saver also. Well, do you know how much you cover per year in private consultants?
That's right.
Right.
So, you know, this...
These yearly amounts?
The three CAFO waste storage grants and the two Ag Nonpoint source grants, those are probably over a two-year time frame. So you're probably talking in the range of $80,000 to $100,000 per year that we're going out to private engineers for. And that's existing. If we had an engineer on staff, we could probably be more efficient, have more opportunity to train that person, be able to get more projects on the ground,
right.
And that would save us more over the long term.
Martha?
You all done, Henry?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask about that because we don't have your whole budget. We just have, you know, we wait on the wrong page. Our allocation to the district is about $250,000. So what's your overall budget?
So operations, with these over OTRs, those about $400,000, just the operations of the district, grant and programmatic budgets. It varies based on how many grants we have, but it's in the range of between $2 and $3 million per year.
Okay.
Dan Klein. Martha's not done.
So the operations of the core staff, about $400 a year.
Yeah, if we included these OTRs.
So then $250. So so the grants, so how, then if you're bringing in, I mean, that's a big proportion. I mean, that's how, like four or five times your base budget is grant money. So how does that work? Does that mean your core staff are being paid by grants? They're all on self-money?
The core staff, myself, the account clerk, our county funding, the technical staff are part county and grant funding. But most of that is, we call it programmatic budget because it's like our AEM program. Our ag person is funded pretty much solely on the AEM funding source. So that's it's a grant, technically. But it's through the EPF, and it's part of state law, so it's pretty secure within the EPF.
So these are grants, but they come every year, basically.
Exactly.
They're fairly stable. It's not competitive. Okay. So I'm sympathetic to this, but it's a big ticket. Mm-hmm. Let me ask. So you said most of your money comes through the Environmental Protection Fund, right? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, the Environmental Facilities Corporation does some similar kinds of funding. Is that no?
EFC does a lot of. They do primarily, usually around water treatment, wastewater treatment, and stormwater. That's usually EFC. I will say the Environmental Protection Fund, that John noted. If you go to that one slide again, John, I mean, is that just for saltwater 300, or is that the total fund? Because there's a lot of brownfield stuff that used to be out of the Environmental Protection Fund.
The $300 million is statewide.
Yeah, so I mean, there was a lot. That covers a lot in the EPF, and it has been on a, as you can see, a lull. I mean, so to see it go up was good news. Hopefully it'll stay at that level, but it's a big fund that covers a variety of areas and the state budget. I even think there's some trail work that falls under EPF before. So that's a snapshot of, it covers a variety of different topics. Yeah, the Environmental Protection Fund.
Okay, I mean, just it sounded close enough to the board that Charlie Krasanski is on.
He is on EFC, yeah.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
Environmental Facilities Corporation,
right.
Different issue, yeah.
So I was just wondering if we could lean on, you know, if there's a way to get some new grants.
No, that would probably be more wastewater treatment, water treatment, maybe stormwater, maybe, but it's generally not. That would be more municipal.
Okay.
Municipal problems, I think.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to Dan.
I was going to ask Jason, okay. Could he give us, you know, his rationale for not including this in the budget?
Sure.
At least either or both of them.
Yeah, I think it's the engineering position is a good. It's one option. Let me back up. The water water quality issue is a big issue. There's a lot going on with it, and there is a lot of different plans and actions out there. And there is some prioritization. I think that we probably need to be a part of. And I know the subcommittee that you're on has had these discussions as well. It's a good request. The question of prioritization is one that I think the legislature needs to consider. You're getting a request from the Water Resource Council for something similar, but not quite. But there is overlap. We have questions about our own staff and what our capabilities are. So it was a blend of all of that and trying to make it fit within the target. It's something that I think that's worth a further discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Now can we go to Dan?
Yeah.
Thanks. I have a few questions. So still going on about the engineer. So when you do projects, isn't there a certain amount that just comes to your office as kind of general money? Okay, let me try this again. If you had an engineer on staff, you could do more projects. That's accurate so far?
Yeah.
Would that result in more revenue to the office? That could, some of that could be applied back to the position?
Not operational revenue. It would be revenue in the form of grants that would be implementation projects.
Program money.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, and then I want to touch on what was just mentioned. We've had this request to fund a position that I've just been calling the Lake Guardian, for lack of a better word, because they were looking at HABs, but also other things, a lot of other things, and coordinating among other all the towns, possibly among other counties, road ditch practices, on and on and on. And when in casual conversations, when I talk to people about it, they all say it should be housed in your office. So I was just wondering if you had some thoughts about that.
We have room for maybe another 2-3 people, so that's an issue. But yeah, I mean, we have soil and water in our name, so there's a lot that can be covered under soil and water. Soil is the foundation of everything. So is water. But yeah, I guess it boils back to what Jason was saying about priorities and what are the priorities for the soil and water district. And really, we've boiled it down to nutrient runoff, sediment, erosion, abatement. And those are big enough projects in and of themselves. We get into hydrilla and some other things. But yeah, there's always opportunity to add more to the soil and water district. And we're always kind of looking for opportunities like that. And this is one request that we put out to the county. And if it doesn't work, we're open to opportunities elsewhere. And that's what soil and water districts are great at, is being flexible enough to be able to find funding where they can.
And then don't need an answer today, but just maybe ask you to do some creative thinking about this. If it turned out that we funded the Lake Guardian and not the engineer, might there be a creative way of shifting around monies within your program to get more engineering?
I'll have to think about that.
I have Dave next. Henry, was your hand up or not? Okay. Then we go to Dave, then Amanda, and Martha.
I just would like to remind everybody that this will increase the efficiency of his department quite a bit. And it's also succession planning, if you will, because we have a part-time engineer at the moment. In addition to that, it's going to bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars more into the county sooner. The more projects we can do, the more people we're going to need. An engineer is only one of those people, but I think it's fairly high priority, I would think.
Just before we go to Amanda, just remind everyone it's now 8:30 and we have another presentation.
I just want to speak to the Lake Guardian, because that has definitely come up, and we talked about it again at the HABS group, and I don't know that there's been an official ask yet, but I think that we and PEAK, I hope, are going to talk about it maybe at the next meeting and what it would look like. I know there's been talk of would it be housed in environmental health or soil and water or planning, and I think it's a really good question, and we've had some good discussions already, but it does need to be ironed out what that would actually look like. And then I just want to note that this might be the only presentation that had a picture of a cow in it. So if that doesn't convince you to go for this,
Martha, can you wrap us up?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Who else might have a cow? So Amanda, you just said so that this. And Jason, you mentioned Water Resources Council. There's nothing here, so there's not.
And I've had a meeting with some folks that want to put forward a request. I've not received anything formally.
They sent us a letter.
They did send a letter.
That's under the planning. WRC is an advisory board under the planning department, and there's nothing here.
Just to clarify, yeah, it's not an official OTR. Okay. No one has put anything in. It was the Water Resources Council and several other organizations and municipalities saying, yes, we want this. I think they would love to have it happen right now, but I think they also just want to open the conversation. If it doesn't make it into this budget, like, let's talk about what that would look like and how we could make that happen for our
I was just trying to make sure I wasn't missing it somewhere.
Yeah, no.
So, okay.
There's nothing official.
All right. But I know in those conversations about the Lake Guardian, is that like a real thing? Okay.
Now it is.
Okay. There's been a lot of conversation about sharing a person with the other counties in we're in three watersheds, but especially mainly the Cougar Lake watershed. So what would it is there any do you think it would make sense to split an engineer position between our county and say Cougar County or whichever, you know, whatever, is that something that would be
so like I mentioned, we're flexible and all opportunities are kind of on the board. I've thought about that, reaching out to specifically Seneca, Cougar County, and seeing if there's opportunities to split a position.
Something that could work if we, if we couldn't afford to fund the whole thing, that might be something that could work.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And it would still improve your efficiency thank you very much, John.
And there's some discussion at the state level, too, of trying to do some of those regional engineering-type positions, but I don't think it's gotten any traction. So,
thanks very much.
John, thank you very much. Your presentation was very clear and helpful.
All right.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Jim, come on up. Tompkins County SPCA, Jim Bogro.
Totally.
Thank you for your patience.
Oh, my pleasure. Fascinating. I'm totally putting cats and dogs in next year's presentation.
Kittens,
all the kittens.
Yeah, where's pictures of kittens?
All right, here we go.
Annie will give you some.
Saddle up. Basically, our 2020 recommended is $37,189, 2% change, no OTRs. Obviously, as part of our overarching spay and neuter program, this critical prevention program basically is providing sterilization. And New York State required rabies vaccinations basically to two cat populations in our community, the feral or free-roaming cats, and the cats belong to low-income or income-qualified Tompkins County residents. So it's just about basically controlling the unwanted pet population and providing rabies vaccinations. So this is actually the data from 2017. I apologize. It's actually up to, and I did send Autumn a revised one of these, but she had a new presentation template, so this might have gotten confused. But stands at 10,112 cats, I believe, sterilized from 2011 to 2018. Last year, there were actually 2,011 cats were serviced in 2018, and we did 1,300 rabies vaccinations. And of those cats last year, I believe it was 422 were actually free roaming. So I do apologize about this not being correct. That's it.
Best presentation yet.
Bringing up the rear.
Do you have a prize?
Let's start. Ann, who knows something about kittens?
Thank you. Just finished up fostering some kittens for Brown Coat Cat
Very
Rescue.
Nice. Thank you.
And we brought three of them in to be spayed and neutered at SPCA.
Yep.
It was very seamless, and thank you for all the help you do with that rescue center and many others.
Absolutely. Obviously we're talking about Tompkins County here tonight, but the program last year serviced residents from 12 other surrounding counties. So it's one of the few places in central New York that people can sort of rely on for regular clinics.
I know for a lot of years, or several past years, people were saying, well, yes, the catch and release program works, and the research I've read recently said that they do have data that that is working.
We do. We struggle because you want to look at some. It's both statistical and anecdotal at the same time, I hate to say it, because you see some changes. Like, for example, for us, since 2009, we see a little over 400 less cats entering the shelter. But because that hasn't been happening, because that's a change for a 10-year period, because it's not happening in large increments in individual years, you don't want to rest on your laurels, so to speak, you know. Could get out of control pretty quickly.
Further questions? Martha?
Just having gotten a puppy at
How's
the
Rosie,
SPCA.
Martha?
Yeah.
How's Rosie?
Rosie's great. Rosie's great.
Tell us about your injuries from the puppy.
About my injuries? Yeah, like the. You know, she's strong. I will say that. I just want to say the spay and neuter program for dogs is working because, like, it's hard to find a puppy.
It sure is. Absolutely. Yeah, and I mean, that goes back to, you know, I think a lot of us know that a lot of that goes back to just philosophies on pet ownership, cats versus dogs, but also municipalities requiring licensing for dogs, and there's really no same mechanism for cats. I mean, you know. So it's people are just, you don't see a free roaming dog population here like you do in places like Alabama where we get some of our transports from.
Actually, there used to be. There was the pack on the Cornell campus. Right?
Oh boy.
Yeah. Anyway, y'all do a great job. Everybody there is so so caring and friendly and helpful.
We have our moments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else for Jim?
No,
that's okay. I live for it. Does everyone want to lean in for an end of night selfie?
Yeah, there you go.
Selfie, selfie.
Thanks, guys.
And Mike dive bombs.
Listen up, folks. Listen, before you go, folks, let me say a couple of things, please.
Yeah, you.
Give me just a second. One, I want to thank folks for their attendance in these four meetings. I'm going to give you a whole week off.
Aww.
However, we do have a legislature meeting, but that's Martha's fault. At the beginning of the next meeting, we'll have a presentation, and we'll start talking about what the process will be to do amendments and or to add new things that you might want to put into the budget or things that you want to delete from the budget, other over-target requests. So at our next meeting, which will be on September 23rd already, that's what we will start out with. So that's what I have to say. Thank you very much.